Grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody, and welcome to the Dudes and Beer podcast. I am Chris Jordan, your host, coming to you live from Austin, Texas tonight. Of course I am. It's not like I'm on the road for work or anything. My God, that would be a dream. Like, I had a dream the other night that I was out on a gig, and I woke up and I was like, I am not in Vegas. And that was kind of saddening. Then I went back to bed. So that's where we're at right now, folks. Still a lot of things to figure out in our great world. While you're online figuring everything out, while you're online tuning us in every week, make sure to stop on by our sponsor, PodcastCadet.com. If you're like I am, you love podcasts, you want to start your own podcast for yourself, your friends, family, school, church, business, whatever, stop on by PodcastCadet.com today. They are the place to get it done. Pretty much what we do over there, folks, is we provide one-on-one podcast audits and consultations. So if you have a podcast that kind of needs to go to the next level, we can hook you up with professionals to check out branding, graphics, social media reach, all that kind of stuff. We hook you up with professionals in those realms one-on-one to give you hourly consultation. It's great. So stop on by and check it out. PodcastCadet.com is the website. The code is DUDES20. That's what you want to use to save 20%. Our guest this evening is the amazing Daniel Allen Jones. He is a researcher into the paranormal, the unknown, the strange, mysterious. Someone like myself who has just kind of tracked these things down through his life and taken such an active interest in them that he can't not explore these things. He can't not go into it. So let's start off with a clip from his YouTube channel, The Vortex, as well as his website, The Vortex Online. We're going to talk about The Vortex, what it is, everything else. Here is a clip of Daniel talking to the indomitable George Norrie.
Daniel here in The Vortex with George Norrie. George,
hey, Daniel,
honor to be
here
with
good
you.
To see you again.
So you encounter so many different incredible people in the field. You cover so many different topics. Tell us, why is it important to investigate extraordinary and anomalous phenomena?
Somebody's got to get the answers to all these unbelievable questions about life after death. Is there Bigfoot? Are UFOs real? Somebody's got to do that. That's one of my jobs. And I will not stop until I get these answers.
I think it's an incredible work that you're doing, so keep it up. We hope to find out a little bit more every day. We're making new discoveries. I like to think we won't know if we don't go.
Watch us on Coast to Coast AM and any station in your city.
We'll see you then in The Vortex.
And there you have it, folks. The reason I chose that is I think it really sums up what Daniel's about, what The Vortex is about, what our mission is about, the fact that we are chasing the tail of truth. We want to know answers. We want to know things from not just armchair experts, but professionals, people who are out in the field doing the research, people like Mike Turber, people like Bingo Minerva, who we had on last week from Lost Gold to World War II, who's out there chasing the trail of Yamashita's gold. So welcome to the show, Daniel, head of the Vortex. How are you this evening?
Hey, Chris. Awesome to be here with you. It's great to be able to connect with another truth seeker, and those who are all of you connecting here is just a wonderful opportunity to see what we can do in networking and just do what we can to make our contribution. So I'm honored to be here with you, Chris.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time, Daniel, because I know you, much like myself, have been affected by this as far as regularity of work, things like that, and schedules are strange. So thank you so much for taking the time to come on, to be on the show, to talk about these things, because as we believe at this show, when we don't talk about these fringe topics, when we don't talk about all these strange things that happen, we stymie ourselves as a culture. We stymie ourselves as people. So to have people like you on, to have people like Bingo Minerva, Mike Turber, other professionals in various fields on to talk about this in educated ways. It's really great to be able to hear that there are so many people out there working on these things.
Yeah, I definitely think so, and wouldn't be here without the incredible inspiration, influence, and encouragement from a lot of my peers and colleagues. I think that that's a big, big part of what we do, is that there's no really singular person, I think, that's handling everything. And I think that you have specialists in these different fields, and we come together, and sometimes we don't. We might bump heads. Overall, I think it's important that we continue making progress, because the world might be on hold for, you know, different things, but it doesn't stop. It keeps going, and we've got to keep up. And these strange things or conventional things are going to happen regardless of if we turn off the news or not. And so someone's got to figure out how to keep up with all of these things and how we can continue making progress in a way that's constructive and doesn't necessarily become a sort of dramatic back and forth of a controversy, but rather, you know, looking to see how we can unify what we're doing and just overall for the betterment of our understanding of our lives and our place in reality.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Because it is about the conversation. That's just it. If we aren't having the conversation whenever we see these topics come up in the news, if we aren't, I mean, even if we aren't having the conversation of what's socially going on in our world and in our country right now, we're the ones who ultimately suffer from it. So you've got to be willing to approach these things and approach these topics in a concept of open mind, open heart, and open discussion, not in a concept of trying to convince somebody to your paradigm.
Right. I think you said it really well with your open mind, open heart, and open discussion. That's a really great way to approach any of these things, because,
yeah,
as you mentioned, I think people really filter out things that otherwise seem irrelevant or aren't pertinent for the time being. Especially right now, I'm sure people could care less, you know, about UFOs and strange encounters and things. But really, it doesn't mean that just because they don't pay attention or they're not acknowledging it, that they're not happening. These things are ultimately everywhere, and I think that they have been an occurrence that we've had a part of our life since the beginning of time, or at least as far as we can remember. So whether we try to filter those things out or not, they happen nevertheless.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And let's start diving a little bit, Daniel, into your background, how you got into this world. What was it that, I mean, myself, it was teaching philosophy and doing broadcast. I caught the broadcast bug years ago whenever I used to guest on a radio show as a musician, and then later on as a broadcast engineer. And after I left, this was just the natural transition for me. So that's what kind of brought me into this world and into researching things in this way. But what was it that brought you to want to start the Vortex and to really kind of start widening out the rabbit hole big enough to fit inside of it?
Right. So to kind of encapsulate the last decade, a little over a decade of my background, basically, you know, going through school and high school, you know, my focus was in music. And while I had interests in things like strange animals and cryptozoology and things like that, I started reading Carl Sagan's Cosmos and Contact and things that really were kind of grounded in hard physical cosmology and science, and that I wasn't really too familiar with as, you know, spiritual concepts, and wasn't something I entertained at the time too much. And then after a few years, I underwent sort of a spiritual experience, I would refer to it as, at the time, that kind of led me into the place that allowed me to be more open to these concepts in a way that I was curious. What was happening to me? What is my place in all of this? And where can I go to find out more? And so I started amassing a large collection of books and being able to, you know, search within my own community of like-minded individuals, groups, or organizations that I might be able to kind of find solace in a way that I didn't really have any strong background. It wasn't a family thing. It wasn't really a whole lot influenced by my friends at the time. So it was really more kind of my own individual journey and diving into all of these special, incredible topics that ultimately led to what the Vortex is now. So throughout that time, I started to find groups and different individuals, and I would, and this is kind of at the beginning of when YouTube was available. So I would watch, you know, whatever was on there about all of these incredible subjects dealing with UFOs or cryptids, Bigfoot and Sasquatch.
Yeah, because it was basically that and death. Cat videos at the beginning.
There really weren't a whole lot of resources, and you know, eventually things got out there, at least online. There were a lot of groups, and at the time, I had no idea. I was barely out of high school and just kind of finding my own place in the world, but it was something that I realized, okay, I can take this as an opportunity to go out and connect. And when I'd say, kind of in a nutshell, the biggest influence I had was Jim Mars, and he was a internationally celebrated journalist and investigative reporter who basically his first big breakthrough that he wrote, the book he wrote, was Crossfire, The Plot to Kill Kennedy, which was the basis for the movie JFK, which, you know, that's a whole other topic. And you know, he eventually wrote Alien Agenda, which became one of the top-selling nonfiction books on UFO studies in the world, and then so on. He covered a lot of very controversial topics. What drew me to his work was that he was very fundamentally working in a way that wasn't just leading into a lot of rhetoric. He always substantiated his claims with either reference or citation of different interviews or people, or it was all very much grounded in the textbook approach of a journalist, which I admired because, you know, there was so much lofty information out there that could not be substantiated, but it was still fun to entertain. So, you know, I've listened to everything. I've heard all these different ideas, but what I really found valuable in that interaction, and I should say that, you know, over the years, I found that he actually lived in my area, so I got to know him through different groups and got to work with him for a while on different things. And along with many other people, you know, I think that he was just one of the primary influences I had at the time, you know, knowing, being able to read some of these books by these authors and then finding out, oh, well, they live right around the corner, so to speak. And then you get connected, and then that sort of spirals into this whole very synchronistic, surreal network of wonderful people. And so that really kind of spearheaded my own journey into, okay, what can I do? And at the time, I was getting involved with different groups, which held meetings and covered lots of different topics. So I wasn't necessarily just pigeonholed into one category area that I felt I'm only drawn to this. And like you said, there's so many different things going down the rabbit hole. You find out there's multiple tunnels, so to speak, that you can go into, and they're all interconnected in some way. They might not necessarily be directly connected, but I think there are some underlying themes. My involvement basically went from hosting different group meetings with people in person, having speakers come out on different topics, and basically making video productions of those meetings. And through my work in video production, I eventually utilized what I knew how to do there and the connections and I was making through networking in these fields to say, all right, you know, well, why don't I do the little that I can, what I know how, to incorporate all of these different things in a way that I can explore them tangibly, whether I'm interviewing people, I'm going out on location, I'm looking at artifacts, I'm going on scene, things like that. I think made it exciting for me to be more involved out into the field while I took what I knew technically with video production to share it with the rest of the world. Whether it was useful to them or not, I felt like at least I could contribute my own small part to that. So the Vortex, I think, is something I've had some friends throughout the years mention. It's kind of like the Twilight Zone. It's almost like, you know, every different segment might be on something totally different, but it's all sort of centralizing around our attempt at exploring the mysteries of the world and beyond. Yep. And one of the catchphrases I like to share about is that we won't know if we don't go. Yeah. And that can be applied in different ways. Maybe we won't know something unless we don't go out into a physical location, or we won't know unless we dive into the archives of, you know, the FBI and CIA documents, you know, like we've been talking about. And I think that it's one of those things that really helps to uncover some of the mysterious qualities that have been known by some agencies or figures or otherwise people who never share it. And I have to really give thanks and appreciation to all the people, whether I've met them or connected with them online or however, that go out of their way to share their accounts of an incident, an experience, an encounter. Because without that, we don't really have a lot to work with. Yeah. I think that probably makes up most of these 4TN, anomalous sort of subjects, because without it, we're left pretty much guessing and studying everything else. And I think it's important that we do acknowledge the scrutiny that a lot of people that come forward can receive and how it'll affect their careers and family and social life.
Yeah.
So, you know, it takes a lot. It takes a lot of courage. And so I'm very glad to be able to, you know, connect with the people that I have. But I think that throughout the years, it's showed me that it's not really just about outlining the experience itself, but what it implies for us psychologically, sociologically, mentally, spiritually, if you want to say that too. But I think it helps us to unveil parts of reality that have been forever present, but we're just now getting to a point where we're able to accept them as a society. And it's something that I feel very drawn to, in a way that, like we were discussing earlier, soon enough, we're going to reach a point where some of these things, through either computer-assisted or AI-assisted technologies, yeah, will be revealed to us in a very prominent way that's going to ultimately change how we understand things, how we ingest new information, and changing the standard for what is acceptable and what is normally understood about our reality. So, to encapsulate all of that, it really started with just understanding my own experience and then going into how do I branch out, connect with the community, and then what do I do to contribute to that community in my own constructive way. I hope it's constructive. You know, people can go on and see the videos and they might laugh or not care at all, and that's totally fine too.
Sure.
But overall, it's something I'm just doing myself, whether it's going to make a big breakthrough or not. It doesn't really seem to strike me as my main driving point. I'm not really making money off of that, so it's not something that I am dependent upon, of course. So
yeah,
a lot of people have the discrepancy of, if you're writing books on these topics or you're doing something like, you know, giving lectures, that you're in it for the money. And, you know, I dare say to anyone that feels or thinks that way, that, you know, give me any example of someone who's had that stature.
Yeah.
And to show how they can outweigh their profit versus the information that might have been provided by that person.
Sure.
That was actually helpful enough to corroborate their making money from it. So, you know, I think a lot of people have that misconception of, well, if you're writing books on UFOs and stuff, then you must just be trying to make a buck. And really, you know, authors don't make a whole lot unless you're several books deep and a very high seller, an international bestseller.
Yeah.
So otherwise, it's really just out of, you know, you taking whoever it is, me, you, Chris, or anyone listening, to take the time themselves to invest in,
that's right,
contributing to our own world and reality to do what we can together.
Well, and that's just it, because I'm sure you learned to play the drums to make a lot of money, right?
Well, you know? So that's my main profession is actually being a musician.
It just the same here. Like, it's like, you know, I spent all that time playing with all these toys behind me so that I could make tons of money. Like, no, I did that because I loved it. Like, money is a great thing. It's awesome. But I'm like, I've got 40 something hours of music that I created that I have never, ever made penny one on. And that's not even the stuff that I recently got a distribution thing for. Like, that's just stuff that I've written that's there. So it's like, I don't care if I ever make money with it. I'm here for the long haul. I'm doing this because I love it. I do this show because I love it. And believe me, whenever I've had, like, about 45 minutes before we went live, the night that we had a member of Anonymous on our show, I don't know a show that Anonymous came on, but they contacted us. And about 45 minutes before we went live, my wife was like, hey, the website doesn't work. Hey, this didn't work.
Oh, no.
Hey, that, like, we started coming under DDoS attack.
Wow.
And it was like,
yeah, I mean, I think,
whoa. Wow. So at those point, you know, yeah, it is the fact of it affects me. I have to be careful some of the things that I do because I got a 3-year-old sleeping on the other side of me. But I'm not gonna let that keep me from exploring, from asking the questions, from talking to people about it.
I think it's something you kind of have to do to put yourself out there on the line. Otherwise, you don't. That's getting back to the whole catchphrase thing is we won't know if we don't go. It's putting ourselves out there on the line, regardless of what might be taking place. So let's say, you know, you have to be careful and be considerate of those around you, family, friends, things like that. But we do have to ask those challenging questions. We do have to go to those places, whether it's virtual or physical, to really find out some of these things that otherwise are veiled to us. Yeah. And I know for sure I've done plenty of things. I look back and I'm like, I was really foolhardy. You know, I went out, I was there by myself and could have easily disappeared. And I'm still here. But I think that you do kind of get those signals of, wow, you know, there are a lot of things that I think are very risky, but the reward sometimes outweighs our risk or discretion of being able to really follow through with thinking about certain things. So, you know, I feel pretty level-headed in my approach. I've entertained a lot of interesting concepts and things. I think I have a pretty good ability of discernment when it comes to, you know, different stories that people share about. But I'm no place to say, well, that didn't happen to you, or that's total BS or something. I'd like to be able to see, you know, what you're going to tell me, regardless of what I know or what I think. It kind of doesn't matter. It's important to be able to feel like whoever it is, the person, people, they can be open and sharing rather than, you know, being scrutinized and ridiculed for an otherwise crazy story.
Well, exactly. You know, because it really is coming at it from a point of compassion to want to know honestly why someone believes something, not to have the conversation because I want to throw something I don't agree with in your face, or because I want to have the last word, or because there's something that I think you believe that I don't agree with that needs to change. But literally having the conversation to genuinely find out what somebody believes and why. And when you find out, just go, wow, never knew that, and leave it.
Right. And I think it's really important for us to be able to not necessarily immediately agree with a stance, but people be open enough to where you can be considerate of it, acknowledge that it is there, whether it falls in alignment with your own or not. And that's one of the reasons why, and I didn't mention this earlier, but throughout my time after studying and researching, I actually went back to school after I was going to school for music. I went back to school and just pursued academics strictly under the guise of interest in philosophy and physics and in astronomy, psychology. I was actually more interested in just seeing how it was presented at an academic standpoint, rather than just to say, I'm going to do this just to get the credit, to get the degree or whatever it is.
Yeah,
and that's where I found there are so many different outlooks, and most of the people in those situations have no idea about the alternatives or the non-academic stance, because either mainstream media doesn't really cover those topics, or they weren't ever exposed to them in other ways. So it was interesting to me because I didn't have to agree with certain things, and maybe some I did, but it ultimately led me to connecting with people of all walks of life, different creeds, different religious backgrounds and philosophies, and different, you know, and getting into the more unconventional things, the alternative sciences and the sort of fringe and gray area that science attempts to find, you know, resolution in. And that gets into some of those strange topics that, you know, we really focus on in the vortex, which I think is kind of the point of what we do, is it's like pushing the limitations of known science so that we can set a better standard for understanding our reality. because without it, we basically just have a our own worldview in our head. Yep. And if we don't accept new information and we filter it out, then we're literally just living with this sort of mythical mindset. And that's a big premise that I introduce in my upcoming book, Mythos. And it has a lot to do with many of these topics in a way that, you know, our belief, our worldview, our perception and awareness of reality ultimately will play a factor in both our own point of view and the place we are in connecting with Absolutely. Each other collectively and up from there.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's all quite literally a process of how we filter reality through past experience in comparison to how we take in new information and filter it through that experience. It's literally the individual mishmash of mentality that happens in our world is what is the beautiful thing, and is absolutely necessary. And one of the topics that we talk about on this show regularly is the science, the religion of science, you know, and the fact that scientists sometimes are so myopic in the fact of they have been researching a field for so long, and this is the standard and the norm within it, that they cannot deviate their thought from that. Like it's just, it's literally anathema for their brain to even think in a converse way.
I think that it could be very compartmentalized and discouraging to approach an outside or alternative view when you're so inured into the methodologies that are prescribed by certain institutions, because you know science isn't really just one entity. It's a conglomerate it's in itself is a working process. Then you have the people who are attempting that work who are sort of stratified. And I think that's a good way to consider how science as a field works is that, you know, ideally we have these concepts that in theory should play out, but because of discretion in certain things like Planck's principle, you know, certain ideologies will persist literally until those scientists die out.
Yeah,
that's literally what Planck's principle is. And you have all these different concepts that play in to how we understand information based upon the sources and the ones kind of within the immediate outreach into academics. So that's why we have a very particular point of view in history, you know, westernized history versus world history or native history, or things that really ultimately we should be knowing and hearing about, not necessarily just from the perspective of this or that. And I think that ultimately gives us a better opportunity for a well-rounded approach as a human society, not just an American society or, you know, European society, but ultimately it's good to acknowledge heritage, cultural value, but not to diminish our place in perception of the world.
Yep. And there is no better way to quite, I mean, I could not have scripted this segue better, Daniel, than to start moving into the topic of cryptozoology from that, and use that statement that you just said about not discounting native teachings when it comes to our modern reality, things like that. These cultures have been around for thousands of years, and they've been around for thousands of years for a reason. It's because they're obviously pretty decent at keeping their culture alive. We can't even keep a culture alive past a fad, like longer than a TikTok video. By the way, gone, everybody. If you got TikTok, I'd say get it off. They've been like, come to find out, they've been gathering people's keystrokes since day one. But to start talking about cryptozoology, specifically the topic of, you know, Bigfoot, Chupacabra here in Texas. One of them that we have and have heard about is the Jaguarless, the Black Panther, that lives in Texas, things like that. These are things that native cultures have talked about for hundreds, if not thousands of years in some cases. And yet still we come in and discount everything and go, well, if we had some science, You know, if we had some scientific evidence, then we could prove what you've been saying for like almost 1,000 years lives in those woods.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of credence for some of these things, in a way that while for the institutions, the scientific agencies that are attempting to verify and validate these claims, which is, you know, we do hope that maybe there is some kind of leverage in what we're experiencing and the people that are having these encounters. Sure. They don't want to be made out to be seem like they're just a fool for having thought maybe it was this or that. And of course, misidentification is a huge part of cryptozoology. It's something that it has happened since the beginning of man's interaction with the rest of nature. And it's yeah. really incredible because Texas, as you mentioned, is full of wildlife, flora, fauna, and all kinds of zoological specimen. And I think that it's really important to consider, you know, Texas is enormous. You've got the ocean, the beaches, the forests of East Texas, the cities, of course, the mountains, mm-hmm. the plains, the hill country, and just every kind of different geographic feature, I think, really
everything but frozen
out.
Tundra. It's the only land type. Like, we don't have that in taiga. That's it. Other than that, right. We got every other land type in the world.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the interesting things is to consider we're bordering Mexico, which yep. is the gateway into Central and South America, where you have an immense collection of traditions and tales of different beasts and creatures that otherwise, you know, in our modern day would seem mythical or seem to be non-existent or have seemed to be sort of regular animals that are given these mystical qualities. And I think that that's a big part of the human story, is to understand things in a way that what we call the gap of the gods works, where, you know, at first everything is, and of course this isn't necessarily a position I'm advocating for people or saying this is what it is, but this is the concept of the gap of the gods in a nutshell, is that all of the world are some god. And then the more that we understand it scientifically, we say, okay, well, it wasn't necessarily God. It was just, you know, maybe this process or this geological phenomenon or something. And then, you know, the more that those gaps become prevalent, it's something that we say, okay, well, maybe we've understood this much, but this small gap still is mysterious enough to say, well, maybe it was God that did it. And I think that the whole concept of gap of the gods is just to show us that the more we learn things about basic qualities of nature and the animal kingdoms, including ourselves, because we are a part of that. People think we're outside of nature. And
no.
It's folly. But I think that it's important to see that it doesn't negate those special tales and traditions. It helps us to understand the cultural lens through which they perceived their reality and
that's
how
right.
it affected their bond with nature and each other. So that's a big tie, and I think it's really interesting to see, because within the field of cryptozoology and the researchers therein, you've got subcultures and sub-factions. You've got those who consider some of these are strictly flesh and blood animals. And then you have the other extremity, where some people say these are animals who can manifest in physical form, but otherwise are nested within some realm that is non-physical, and they have non-physical qualities or abilities. And although may appear as conventional animals like the jaguar, which, you know, in many ways in Southern American cultures is a very mystical creature. And some of these animals would just be omens, purely omens of harbingers in some sense, that can allow for us to understand maybe something to come, a sign, so to speak. And I think that our reality helps us to still gauge things in much of the same way. We just have a better technical and sophisticated approach in the modern day and age. So getting back to the whole jaguar big cat issue in Texas is very, very muddy, because yes, we do have conventional cats which are misidentified.
Sure.
We do have other animals that sometimes get caught on trail cams and game cams, and you have physical sightings and encounters.
Yeah.
And then you have audible, and this, again, these all are things that are seen with many, you know, types of cryptids, which are the creatures that we call these animals within cryptozoology. So whether it's Bigfoot or the chupacabras you mentioned, or any of these other, and these are all things in Texas as well.
Yeah.
And I think that whether you approach it from the many spokes of the wheel that is cryptozoology, whether it's accounts of eyewitness testimony, you have audible vocalizations from these creatures that can be recorded with our, you know, digital recorders or phones or whatever it is. You have the samples of blood, scat, hair, DNA, whatever it is, alleged, you know, and you have the what's left behind, the remains of, let's say, those things, plus footprints, depressions in the ground, castings of those footprints. And, you know, that with all those things combined within any given, you know, court of law, I'd say that 9 out of 10, you'd end up finding that these things are going to be something one might find believable, but believing it doesn't necessarily change its existence or not. I think it all boils down to,
yeah,
coming to a collective agreement. And this comes back to what we were saying earlier, coming to a collective agreement upon a phenomenon and saying, okay, we can acknowledge its existence. Now we must set a new standard for understanding our reality. We can't just ignore it and filter it out any longer. And I think that regardless, people will still do that. It's important that there are a few who do choose to continue making the progress regardless of what people filter in of their belief. And so, yeah, these cats, these mystery cats, are seen all over. Some of the melanistic cats and the non-melanistic cats can give people the impression that maybe mountain lions have had some hybridization. But then you have the straight up jaguar style cats, which we're told aren't supposed to be in Texas. And while, you know, this isn't necessarily something super unnatural or super natural, I think that,
yeah,
you know, it goes to show that life really can get around. And maybe there are other factors. Maybe there are some exotic pets that were released.
Sure, sure.
And maybe there were some of these hybrid cats that came up from Central America. And just a quick note on that, not to really get too politically oriented here, but one of the factors involving the establishment of a giant wall would actually be extremely an extreme detriment to
wildlife.
It would seem to be a detriment anyway to the wildlife,
yeah,
and around the area and its ability to be nomadic, because it's not like people. Animals aren't like people. We don't settle and stay there for the most part. They,
yep,
they travel a range and a radius of several miles,
right,
and to have a border there is going to really going to have a big detriment on the diversity of wildlife within Texas and other states, because it's not something that's just pocketed groups.
Yeah.
And as far as we know, you know, it'll be hard to understand how that's going to be affected until it happens, if it happens. We'll see. You know, so not to really dwell too much on that, but just simple things, land barriers,
absolutely,
water barriers, all of these are a factor in what kind of animals we're going to encounter here in our immediate area.
Yeah, precisely. And, you know, especially whenever you're talking about things like cougars, mountain lions, that kind of stuff, they've got a home range of 3 to 5 miles. Like they range. So it's not uncommon to see that kind of stuff. And whenever you're talking about, I've got the article up on screen right now from Texas Hill Country about the jaguarundis, and that's the Black Panther. The reason I brought that up this evening is because it is a long-standing debate between my brother and my cousin and I. I swear to God, at a family gathering in Louisiana, that we were all sitting around a campfire. It was about midnight. And I was like, hey, everybody, look at that cougar over there.
Oh, nice.
And they're like, literally, oh, what are you talking? I'm like, look, I'm not even joking. Like 50 feet that way, there is a cougar. Everybody said I was crazy. And then I started looking things up. And then I found out about the jaguarundis. And I'm like, look, I'm telling you. I told you. So
right.
I had,
that's another big thing is that, you know, maybe it could be, and I think at least as far as the pronunciations I'm familiar with,
Jaguarundi.
Jaguarundi. Yeah. And I think that that's one of the things that people say, well, it might not have been a jaguar, but rather,
yes,
this jaguarundi. And maybe that can be the case for some sightings, but the problem is that, and this is the same case with any of these topics, once a scientific institution comes in and says, people are not seeing this, they're seeing this, they're setting a widespread,
it's a swath of an answer, yeah,
are that, rather than addressing individual cases in a way that is just painting a picture of the entirety of the phenomenon rather than addressing the enormous diversity of it. And just like Bigfoot, the problem is once science comes out and says, yeah, Bigfoot's real. And so, you know, well, that doesn't necessarily address anything really.
No,
it actually just makes things more confusing because some people might have seen something totally different or similar, but it doesn't actually say what it is they're dealing with. It's really just an umbrella term. And I think that that's one of the challenges we have, even when science is involved, is that when people see these things, they're all seeing something different. All of them. They all might have similar qualities, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're all the same. And that's where we're at.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting because even the article that I just brought up on screen a minute ago is the ocelot being found in Texas for the first time in 20 years. It used to have a home range here. It became endangered. I remember up around the time I got out of high school, I remember it being on the endangered list. And now it's apparently made a return. But if you look at an ocelot, folks, like, it's basically a tiny leopard about twice the size, maybe three times the size of your common house cat. A little bit bigger than a bobcat, you know. But the only way that you can get the melanistic mutation that is a Black Panther is with a spotted coat. The Black Panther is not actively black, folks. It is a melanistic mutation. It is nothing different than a regular jaguar. If you look closely, you can actively see the black rings inside the fur. So to think about the fact that maybe it's just a melanistic ocelot along those lines, perfectly within the realm of science.
I think so. And it would be possible for that to account for at least a portion or percentage of sightings, maybe not all of them.
Yeah.
But that's the whole point of cryptozoology, is that, you know, that prefix crypto means hidden, or, and sort of modern nomenclature, we like to think unknown. And in doing so, it gives us an opportunity to figure out what are these things, even if it's conventional. Like, if you can tell that for sure, like you had your encounter in Louisiana, you could tell that was a felid or a feline.
Yeah.
It wasn't a dog, or it wasn't a you know, snake, you know. No, you could tell
that was
the
cat.
Basic animal class, right? And then from there we have these discrepancies. Was it melanistic, non-melanistic? Was it a panther or mountain lion? Was it a cougar, jaguar, jaguarundi? All of these sub classifications are what make the this area more gray and indiscernible in a way that otherwise, you know, we need a more clarified clear attempt at figuring out what's going on. And that's the challenge of science, is not to say here's the overall blanket statement of what it is, because that would be an enormous disservice to any zoological endeavor. I think it's important that we acknowledge, just like you said, these ocelots, if people are seeing them, you can't just be like, well, those are extinct, so that must not be an ocelot. That would immediately be a disservice to the scientific approach. And you have to say, well, if this is what could be the ocelot, then maybe our working model, we don't just say because our model says this, that's what stays. We have to go with what nature gives us, because that ultimately is what science is an attempt to understand, not the other way around.
Yeah. And I just brought up an ABC News article as we were talking. It cued into my brain, like, dude, the Tasmanian tiger was thought to have been hunted to extinction during the big game hunts of the 20s and 30s.
Right, the thylacine.
Like, yeah, precisely. Like, nope, there are sightings of it going on. This article right here is from 2019. So as early as last year, same thing as the coelacanth. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, when that was caught off the, I want to say it was Cape Horn up around there, where they caught the supposedly extinct prehistoric fish. We find things all the time. And one of the things that we try to point out on this show is that, A, science is supposed to try to disprove theory. There is nothing wrong with coming up with the craziest hypothesis in the world. The idea is, the idea, take it. The idea is to like, you're allowed to make the crazy hypothesis. You're supposed to disprove the hypothesis. And
right.
somehow or another, we lost sight of that. And yes, there's scientific fact, but at the same time, you know, hey, until like 1500, the world was flat, straight up. We knew that scientifically, mostly to say anything else, like you were burned at the stake. You were a heretic. People literally thought you fell off the earth till some dude had the chutzpah to try it otherwise.
That's it. That's the whole, you know, point of what we were saying is unless you really go there and
yeah.
you push the standards of known science.
That's it.
And worldviews, then we're stuck and we stagnate and we don't make progress. And that's the whole point of our development, I think, is to really push that to our evolution, not necessarily our physiological evolution only, but really our ability to evolve in our totality of being, whether that's
yeah.
physically, mentally, you know, emotionally, because a lot of these things are emotionally driven as well. People want to believe that these creatures exist. And, you know, sometimes it makes us wonder how much does that play a factor into the reality around us? And that touches into a lot of quantum concepts and things, but it, you know, in a way that is different. But if we really look at it, there are so many people who just, they believe in Bigfoot. They might not have ever had an encounter or sighting, but they like the idea so much they're willing to believe that something is out there. And I don't necessarily like to use the word myself, I guess because of my own background and my
okay.
own stance, I like to say my estimation and my best estimation of the known material that I have encountered.
You're like me. I like that.
But, you know, I think it's really important to clarify in those types of situations.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, it's just something I have a personal view on, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm, hey, my audience knows whenever I'm going to let you know my personal view, I'll let you know my personal view. Like, I'll say it right now, just because Ghislaine Maxwell was arrested, folks. I still think Jeffrey Epstein is in police custody. He is. I call it still to this day. It's going to happen. I'm telling you.
There's a lot of hidden public stage that we don't know.
Exactly. And, you know, there's so many things that pop up. Like, I did not know as much research as I have done into this topic, Daniel. I literally came into so many varying topics. I literally came into the living room. When did I send you the promo? Yesterday was when I sent you the promo post. And I was like, sweetheart, I know, like, you weren't into topics like I am, things like that, but did you happen to know that there was an actual 22-page FBI report on Bigfoot?
Yeah.
And I sent you a link to it.
It's eye-opening to lots
and,
of people.
Yeah, and when you – I've got it up on screen here, folks. As always, I don't just tell you that it exists. It is right there on the Dudes and Beer website. Feel free to go to dudesandbeer.com/knowledge vault. Go down to the scientific section, and that is where you will find all of our good stuff, scientific documents. Or no, this is actually UFO and paranormal because it's Bigfoot. But yeah, there it is, like 22 pages from December of 1976. And they go into materials that they studied. Hairs that were found, things like that. And when you're talking about like hair examiners, the FBI is pretty good at it. Even in 1976,
like to think so, you know?
Even in 1976, they were pretty good at it.
Right. And just a, you know, a note on, and while we're discussing cryptozoology,
yes.
I think it, for anyone, because, you know, take my word for it, not, it doesn't really affect me if you believe anything I say or not, but I would
yeah.
say don't just listen to me. I'm going to give you a list of names that I think are very impressionable to not just me, but in the field overall, that I think anyone out there listening who's interested in the subject, who's skeptical, please be skeptical first off. And
yes, always.
And then please utilize your interest to drive that and fuel it further into maybe at least learning a little bit about wildlife for yourself. Don't
yep.
just do it out of I'm going to discover Bigfoot and find all the details.
Yeah.
Do it out of the love of nature and wildlife around us. That's super conventional and in no way paranormal or anything like that.
No.
Do it because it's part of something we need to know before we jump to the most obscure conclusions. And I think that's
right.
One of the things we deal with in this field is that everyone wants to jump to the most inane, ridiculous things before we address simple, known wildlife facts. So one of the groups that I share my information on here in our state, the Texas Cryptozoology Network, deals primarily with basic animal and wildlife studies. And almost, you know, a minimal of the posts are jumping into the extreme strangeness of, you know, the strange cryptids, and which is good, too. I think those things are really fascinating. But we need to focus on the main aspects of wildlife as well. And I think that's something we all need to look at in a way that we understand better. But the getting back to the names, I want to throw out a few here that I think are incredibly useful in their work and the breadth of what they cover overall. And these are just people that I've met, known personally, or are my friends. So first off, you've got Lauren Coleman, who's the curator of the International Cryptozoology Museum of Maine. You've got Ken Gerhard, who just authored The Essential Guide to Bigfoot. Definitely go pick that up if you're interested. It's like the book on Bigfoot that just came out. Nick Redfern, who spans a lot of these topics that we've been discussing.
Here in Incredible Texas, guide. Correct?
And right. And all, well, Nick Redfern and Ken Gerhard, they both are, along with my buddy Lyle Blackburn. He just came out with a new book as well. And along with our friend Craig Woolheater, who's the head of the site Crypto Mundo and the Texas Bigfoot Conference.
Yeah.
Amazing conference. You Which guys is, check it out.
I think that may be how we cursorily got connected to begin with, was he was on our show and then we kind of crossed bridges through him.
Right.
And I wanted to go to the show this last year so bad, and then I ended up being in D.C. in October. And could not make it, and I was very disappointed, and had it on my schedule this year for it. So the fact that there are, and that's just it, folks, there are conferences about this stuff. Of course there are. There's conferences about everything.
But
whenever you're talking about cryptozoology, it's a topic that's near and dear to my heart, because it is one of those that leans heavily on a lot of story, leans heavily on a lot of history, and starts going into science, especially whenever you start seeing things like from the FBI, where literally they say, like, hey, you know, briefly, we did, this is from page 2, we do not often come across hair which we are unable to identify. And the hair that we have now, about 15 hairs attached to a tiny piece of skin, is the first that we have attained in 6 years, which we feel may be of importance. And, you know, this is it's interesting to me that the state of Oregon, I believe, has Sasquatch as a protected animal in its state parks.
Washington does, for sure.
Oh, Washington. It's Washington.
But Oregon might as well. I'm not sure if they've got anything. But, yeah, there is sort of a tongue-in-cheek, but very real, legal place.
Well,
that I think has to be made known, because there's where other, I mean, maybe Texas could eventually do something like that, because we actually have an enormous percentage of the overall sightings in the, in the country. But I think that legally, as far as legal goes, Washington seems to be the only state with any kind of restriction or placement or punishment per se on that. And which is probably a good thing, you know, that even that sort of acknowledgement is really important. But yeah, just to throw out a few more, we've got Jeff, the Crypto Hulk Stewart, Chester Moore, both amazing wildlife guys. You've got people like Adam Davis, World Explorer, David Weatherly, and of course, I'll just mention you probably heard of the new show. Many of you listening probably have the new Bigfoot show that's come out with Russell Accord, who's basically the manager of Bob Gimlin, who was one of the two people who had the Patterson-Gimlin encounter back in 67.
The Gimlin behind the film.
Right. And so a lot of these people I've done interviews or little cutaway segments with at conferences that you can go on to our YouTube channel and just kind of garner your interest with these different things, because we like to discuss all the different wildlife aspects of these creatures, not just primarily Bigfoot, but what does this mean for the rest of our understanding of animals and the zoological creatures out there. So I like to connect with these guys on a lot of these things. And, of course, Cliff Berrickman and James Bobo Fay from Finding Bigfoot. Very interesting guys, great work. And, you know, there's so many, I could just keep going on and on, but I'll just leave it those guys. And if anyone who's interested, I'm sure we can provide contact info for for me to help, you know, to share the reference or resources that I'm kind of giving out.
Yeah, most definitely. And it really is much like the podcasting world. This whole community is about community. It is really interesting the way that paths cross, handshakes are made, because it is very much people leaning on each other's situation, whether it comes to cryptozoology. Lauren Coleman is one of those that on occasion I would be driving back from a band rehearsal with a band that I would work with, because I lived in Portland, Maine for six years, and I did not know until I saw him, because I listened to him on Coast to Coast all the time, things like that. And then I saw his car go by one day, and I was like, no. And then I saw the license plate, and I was like, oh my God, that's Lauren Coleman. And then come to find out, like, Freddie Silva lives right up the road. I was like, dude, I had no idea these people were literally my neighbors. he opened the Cryptozoology Museum like probably about 3 months after I left town up there. Oh. I've been so disappointed that whenever I've gone up, it's either never has not been open because it's a closed day, or I just didn't have the time to swing up to Portland and go see it. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting the way that paths cross in this little world, because it really is a point of support. Like you were saying earlier, the fact of we're here to support each other's stories. We aren't here to necessarily poo-poo what somebody's saying, or to say like, oh yeah, dude, did you get some of what that guy was smoking? There's none of that going on. We're open hearts, open minds. That's what we're supposed to be here in order to have this conversation. And
absolutely.
Especially now with, just to kind of switch gears here to start going into the disclosure world. It's been interesting to see what has come out in the last year or so. In the last 2 years, from the federal government, from scientific communities, all kinds of stuff, and even the Stars Academy, them teaming up now with the federal government and the Air Force.
It's pretty interesting, and you know, when we're talking about disclosure, I think I hear this a lot because it's thrown out at events and people ask about what, you know, when is disclosure happening? And some people, they say, well, what do you mean disclosure? Because of course that's sort of now an umbrella term, usually relating specifically to UFOs or ufology, things along those lines. But ultimately I think that, like we discussed before we came on, that doesn't just imply the physical sightings or even just the craft themselves or whatever it is, objects, but so many other prongs that span out from the phenomenon that would ultimately append, you know, the engineering crisis, the energy efficiency, so many things sociologically that we would have to redirect and address in a way that, again, not reality. So when it comes to disclosure and the parties, the factions involved, there's a lot at work. I attribute some of the things coming down the line that have come out. A good buddy of mine who I've known for a long time, but you know, he's just now been more active on the scene, is my good friend Danny Silva with the Silva Record, which is now like a hot spot for most all of the UAP, UFO government information coming out. And we got to meet Lou Elizondo in person at a private meeting last year, and it was a big eye-opener, considering that, you know, there was still a lot of controversy surrounding him as his involvement with, not only, like as you said, to the Stars Academy. For those who don't know, Luis Elizondo was the front person for, like, the director for the Pentagon's UFO investigation program called ATIP, which is Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. And this is something that, you know, a lot of people only heard about until, or didn't hear about until a few years ago when they made a big announcement. It came out in the New York Times. One of the authors of that article was Leslie Kane, who I ended up meeting with as well. And so, again, like you said, when we connect with these people and go out of our way to connect these dots, I think it really becomes more eye-opening than just passing by a mere article or a clip on the news that's just really brief. And you say, huh, that's neat. Well, back to whatever. It really shows that there's a lot going on behind the scenes. These people are very real. Their involvement is very real.
Yeah.
They have a lot to show they have a lot that they haven't been able to show, but that they do have. And I think that's the big takeaway we had, was that there's so much that I think that could be released that everyone wants. Everyone's just a big outpour as disclosure altogether. However, it's just one of those things that pretty much just comes like at a very slow pace or a controlled pace. And I, you know, some of the other big members that I've been able to and fortunate to connect with, like Richard Dolan and Grant Cameron and Joe Mergia and Melinda Leslie and several other people, I could go on and on, but, you know, in within the realm of ufology, again, you have so many different sub areas and sort of subcultures that people, like these factions, basically, that people sometimes get along, sometimes they don't, sometimes they refute information, sources, they refute people's opinions or statements. The trouble is that there's a lot of infighting, and it's becoming a sort of cesspool for people to, new people coming in to make sense of. And I think that it's important to, and what Jim, you know, my buddy Jim Mars, the late Jim Mars, would always say is that, you know, it's important to always question authority, but also keep your mind open, but not so open that it's going to fall out.
Yeah.
And, so I think it's important that you just, you digest information appropriately, but you don't believe just everything out there, because then you're lost to think, you know, what's really going on. When you have so many different angles within the UFO subject, I think it's important to use your discernment in a way that you can read something without being in total disgust or disagreement, but you can still consider it, acknowledge it as a point of view or a source of information and move on, or utilize it to corroborate other substantiating points of information, which is what we do when we're gathering data and we're researching. We find things that make sense. We might sometimes inadvertently find things that try to, be used to make sense out of something. You have to be careful about that, because sometimes it's easy to find evidence for something you're looking for when there is none.
Yeah, precisely.
And just do what you can, you know.
Well, you've got to be careful of confirmation bias. You've got to be careful of the fact that you are not presenting yourself from being presented with the truth, just because you don't believe something, or because it is conflicting to your personal belief doesn't mean it's not the truth. Not too long ago, it was 2 years ago, we had a data specialist on that I literally met at a bar during South By, who was in from Florida. And he's like, yeah, you know, I work big data and crunch numbers and write AI and programs that figure out large numbers for major companies. And he was like, I think what people forget in society, which is very interesting to me, is it's all just data. Why are you so entirely enraged about what somebody says? It's just a point of data.
Exactly.
It's
I think
like,
that
it's a
like
point
we
of
were saying about emotionally
datum.
Attachments.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah. We get really hung up on the fact that what they're saying is against us, and we don't just look at it as datum, which is a single point within a set of data. That's it. So
I'm really glad you brought that up, because not a lot of people really, I'm sure, of course, for those who are, you know, the retention of your listeners probably know that you cover that a lot. And I think it's important that you do, because not a lot of people realize that what you just said is such a big part of how we should ascertain our information and not just do it out of emotional bias.
That's
that
right.
That we disagree or agree with, but you just have to go with what's there.
Yeah, precisely. You can be passionate. I'm not saying don't be passionate. I'm saying be just as passionate about considering it only a point of data.
Right.
Balance out
this
your passion
you
with the
sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. You know, because yeah, it's hard. It's hard, man. Like when, especially once you start getting tied up in some of this web that you and I deal with, researching topics, dealing with people, dealing with guests, friends, that kind of stuff that are within these communities. There's a lot of webs in there. And they shake a lot of things, and you really do have to kind of be careful with how you process information and how you present information. As you said earlier, whenever you're talking about Bigfoot or other cryptids, you have like a specified thing that you say to indemnify yourself, just so people fully understand.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think for myself, it's important because otherwise it can be very misleading and yeah. things get taken out of context. And while most people probably don't cut even, maybe not that they don't care, but they don't, they aren't able to be considerate of those things and how they affect our interpretation of information and each other. Because a lot of times anyone could easily say, yeah. whether you know them or not, their friends, family or not, total strangers on the bus or whoever it is, you know, they yeah. could say, hey. Do you believe in X, Y, or Z? And any you know, one of those things could be what we're talking about. And, you know, the whole premise of the question is leading into a fixed sort of idea about something that they're asking. Whether they are intending that or not, you have to understand, you know, the whole parameter of the inquiry. And I think that most people aren't even going to think that far ahead. They're just going to either say yes or no, and here's why. So,
yeah.
you know, for me, I couldn't say no because to me, I would just say my thoughts on the matter are, or my, like I said, my best estimation is, or based upon the information that I've gathered, things like that show that you know, yeah. I'm not just saying, well, I believe it because it sounds great, or that because I mean, sure, I could say I believe it because all of these high caliber people said so.
Yeah.
Sure, that makes sense. And it, you know, for the purpose of conversation, it works. But at the same time, I think it's important to show, okay, for the people who are out there, it doesn't matter if I believe Bob Gimlin or not.
Yeah.
It's something that you have to say, okay, based upon his account or anyone, you know, that's just, I think, one of the staples of the yeah. Bigfoot subject. You know, you say whether you believe him or believe that whole thing or not is regardless, it doesn't really affect the event itself. The event happened or it didn't happen. Whether you believe it or not.
Yeah.
So the problem is that we kind of get tied into these cultural beliefs, these cultural values that we place a lot of merit or maybe not enough merit in. And because of that, we let things kind of go to the wall, which is kind of the whole point of, I think, the Bigfoot subject is most people just think, it was just a silly costume video from the 70s, which, you know, is actually yeah. incorrect because it wasn't in the 70s, it was in 67, and here's how many things you could refute about that. So the whole thing is people don't know because they've been erroneously exposed to bad information and yeah. bad science. And I think that people don't, they're not considerate of that. But again, shifting gears into the UFO phenomenon and the many spokes that spring from that, I think are really a big area to focus on here in the next several years, because with as much technology and like you were talking about the guy doing big data, there's so much out there that's going to be highly encrypted, highly classified and very yeah. deep within what are called special access programs
yep.
within compartmentalized agencies and parts of the government that, of course, you know, it's not like everyone at the White House or in Congress has any idea about UFOs. There might be some people here and there that have had a clearance that led them to being able to have access to information, limited information about a particular project.
Yeah, within select House committees, things like that.
Exactly.
Because you, so, I mean, if you're going to sit on a Department of Energy House committee, you have to have a certain amount of clearance. Those are the people talking about nuclear bombs.
And that's a really important part of defense secrecy, is it's not just about the ultimate mysteries of what the government knows or doesn't know. It's about very practical and conventional things, too, like Homeland Security or defensive airspace. You know, it would be kind of a letdown for them to say, hey, guys, you know, there are these things going around up in our sky, you know, that we just can't do anything about. So sorry about that. But we just, you know, we'll never hear a statement like that. I'm very doubtful of, but maybe, you know, I don't think we will. But
well,
it's one of those things that we just have to live with, knowing that they can't account for some things and they're not going to admit to some of those things. Like we said before, any notion of some of these small little bits and parts are such a detriment to the admission of an entire mammoth of a cover up that it would it's Pandora's box, and it's just amount of time, I think, before before private groups or organizations utilizing advanced computer technology, specifically the AI industry, are able to uncover these things in a privatized way outside of an official or government way that are going to start getting things seen. I think a good example of this is what Elon Musk is doing. This, you know, and as much as people like or don't like him, it's aside the point. He is probably one of the most.
I love that guy. He doesn't care. He just goes for it, man. If he sees he's like, yeah, man, I want to put some money into that. The fact that he made his patents just open.
It's unheard of. You know, I think that it's really important to see, just again, whether people like him or don't like him, he is. People like that are our best opportunity at investing privately and publicly into understanding some of these things, otherwise which the government has otherwise not let on hardly at all about, with the exception of a few leaks here and there, which were never intentional, which I want to point out really quick, because this was a major, major deal here that has been going around. Some people, you might have heard of it too. Some people kind of just catching up to speed. You have what's called the Wilson memo or leak, essentially. And you know, you could have a whole show. You could have several shows on this. We're not going to get too deep into that because I think it's another rabbit hole. But the point of that is that you have an admiral, high-ranking government official, Admiral Wilson, who basically became part of a meeting with other people, other very high echelon scientists, particularly Dr. Eric Davis, astronaut Edgar Mitchell, and a few other people, part of the this sort of group. It was the Bigelow Aerospace, you know, advanced aviation and sciences, BASS or BASS, another one of those groups, kind of the predecessor to ATIP. Because all the stuff that the government got on UFOs, they kind of sent over, or at least a portion of whatever agency got them, you know, sent over to Bigelow. You know, so they're sending out this stuff to private contractors, and now they're being locked away into these private contractors that the government's wrestling to, you know, and it's, I'm not just throwing flack at Bigelow, but just things like that, these special access programs, and then you have unacknowledged special access programs, which dig really deep into the rabbit hole of stuff that, you know, will... There's a great quote. Some people say it's not a legitimate quote, but it's by Ben Rich, who was this CEO of Lockheed Martin and Skunk Works, who says basically that, you know, we have all the technologies. We've got the technology to take ET home. We've got everything you could think of, basically, and I'm paraphrasing here, but basically he acknowledges that it would take an act of God to get these out of the black projects and into the public domain. And, you know, of course, you hear a lot of interesting things, like you said, the TR-3B, all this stuff, you can find sort of trails of breadcrumbs too. And getting back to the Wilson document, what it acknowledged was that this high-ranking official had a meeting about UFOs, about retrieved crash debris, and things that otherwise were never supposed to get out, but did, because Dr. Edgar Mitchell passed away and his notes ended up getting out. And so people found out about this. And then other researchers ended up kind of investigating and just finding more of the trails, connecting the dots. And again, this is some people, like Richard Dolan calls find of the century, the leak of the century, or something to that effect. Yeah. One of the most important discoveries when it comes to UFOs or ufology, because what it shows is that there is definitely not only just an admission, which these people are all denying, and of course that's kind of what their job is to do, is, you know, to professionally say never happened and just deny it altogether. But when you have these high caliber government officials and scientists meeting to discuss these kinds of topics, and you can factualize it and back it up by the documentation, the accounts of very high caliber and reputable, or yeah, considerably reputable and incredible people. Again, that doesn't mean that it's true. It just means that, you know, some people would believe them over just some guy off the street. You know, some people, generally speaking, yep, tend to agree more with an astronaut than if they said something than just some no name like me, who's going to just tell you, believe this, because, you know, if you hear an astronaut say something, most people are going to say, for sure, that's probably the case.
Yeah.
So based upon those things, high caliber testimony and these other contributing factors, the Wilson memo, alleges that some of these special access programs, and also Dr. Stephen Greer wrote about this. And again, these are all different figures. No one better than the other, but yeah, all contributing different relevance in the whole scheme of it. Basically, this high-ranking government official, Wilson, attempted to gain access into these projects after the briefing, after the meeting, and was denied. And because of that, they followed up, and he tried to go kind of behind the doors to came across what he was looking for, basically, according to Richard Dolan, and found that, okay, maybe he could try again. So he tries allegedly a second time to gain access to something, this, you know, black budget special access program that dealt with ET technology, allegedly. And I think that that's one of the things that, shows that, okay, this, yeah, is not just hearsay, or at least to the ones that are following along with this in great detail. You know, some people think the whole thing's a hoax, which is fine. But I think that there's enough to show that there is a strong indication that this, not only did the meeting take place, but everything else did. So the meeting for sure took place. Mm. Whether this guy, whether these programs that he was attempting to gain access to are there or not, you know, that's, we'll have to wait for more to come out about, yeah, that. However, I think, you know, most people could just believe that they're there, and sure, it's a fun idea, or maybe not fun, but like a interesting idea. It's curious, but are they there? I think for sure that there's the notion that these black budget projects and these unacknowledged special access programs, I think there's enough credence to show that they do exist, or at least have existed in some form, regarding reverse engineering or, yep, backward engineering of exotic and advanced technologies. Now, I'm pretty careful on my wording on this, because, you know, a lot of people tie this into the ET, yes, subject, the ET phenomenon. Yes. And I don't negate that possibility. But the more and more I look into this, and I look into contributing areas of research that are also of interest to the FBI and the CIA at a very deep level, and concern to leading scientists, is the component of consciousness, of advanced civilizations, of things like simulation theory, and the utilization and engineering of these technologies. And so what I think we need to more appropriately be able to address is that it's not really something we just need to jump ahead. And maybe it is. Maybe they know for sure. Someone out there is, oh yeah, this technology is from this group made by, you know, this group from this place. Maybe someone out there does know those specificities. But for, yeah, the common person, you know, the lay person out there, that would never be like publicly available unless like this note, or, you know, notes on this memo were leaked inadvertently, or a whistleblower came out, or things, yeah, that eventually could be declassified and disclosed upon. Now, granted, none of those things have really happened in such a way that could reveal too much. We can just estimate. And I think that what we're looking at is, we need to consider the possibility that some of these advanced findings, or the findings of advanced materials and exotic technologies, should not only just be thrown into the umbrella of extraterrestrial biological entity engineering, but perhaps just non-human intelligence altogether. Because EBE, which is the acronym of the term I just used, should imply a sense of let's say, origin, whereas we probably don't know that for sure. And like I said, maybe we do. I don't discount that. But it's more likely that we're dealing with something beyond our immediate comprehension, unless there was a way to derive the origin of the source. Otherwise, it would be like, okay, is there something in the ship? And I'm just throwing out a hypothetical here. Mm-hmm. Is there something in the ship or on the debris that says, from Texas, made by Texans? You know,
exactly. So is it like a Dodge tag?
Right. You know, or is this a Honda Civic?
Yeah.
Is it a, you know, whatever. Well, so is it something that we can derive the source from based upon known materials and origin, or is it something that we're estimating based upon the what's called the ETH, the extraterrestrial hypothesis, which again is pigeonholing us into a challenge of science to say that all of these things are ET. Whereas, like you said earlier, well, maybe they're not all ET. Maybe some of them are government objects.
Hey, they could be extra dimensional.
Exactly.
They could be coming from a parallel Earth. You know,
exactly. And I think that's important to consider those alternatives.
Yeah, precisely. Like you were saying, to pigeonhole it into that terminology is tough. It's hard. That's how you end up with that horrible terms like conspiracy theorists, domestic terrorism, that are just the catch-all phrase that lets you just sweep it all away.
Right. And I think it's one of those things that when the common person who doesn't have like too big of a relevant interest, but they might be curious.
Yeah.
Their big takeaways are going to be the things that stand out from the official standpoint. And I think that, you know, because they're more willing to listen to that or the government or military or credible, reputable people like astronauts and such.
Yeah.
Rather than just some person like me or whatever saying this is what you have to know or believe. I think it's really important that they see that the information can be backed up with valid sources and maybe sometimes is backed up with invalid, intentionally disinformation sources. And that's the challenge as well, is how much of these projects have been deliberately made into something that is supposed to disinform us about the reality of where its origins or something like that. So there's so many different doors and veils that we have to go through that are making it difficult to see really what's out there. And you know, there's so much we could get into that. I just want to make mention as far as that Wilson memo for those who are really particularly interested in saying, well, I want to know more about that. Go check out Danny Silva's blog, Silver Record, and then also Joe Mergia, UFO Joe.
Okay.
And there's a lot of other guys doing a great job. Giuliano Markovic, and just some buddies that I think are part of the whole, what are called the young guns crowd, which, you know, Grant Cameron sort of gave us this title. I don't think that the title really, you know, should matter much. It's just this idea that there's sort of a new insurgence of people who are kind of coming onto the scene later to see that there's a lot to it and we got to figure it out.
You know, man, I have struggled, for 5 years as to whether or not to, especially the last three, as to whether or not to rebrand this show. And it's one of those like, no. Number one, the title, the innocuous title, probably allows me to run underneath most algorithmic radars just off the top.
Right. No, it's great. And actually wanted to point out something. It's funny though, because, and this has a little bit to do with the theme of the show we're talking about, as well, when you have some of these things cross over, it kind of makes for some great humor and
it does.
Good time. So I'm going to send you this picture here on our Skype call that is something that just came out. And I'll just mention this briefly. I know we're going on all these tangents, but
that's cool.
Because the show, you know, Dudes and Beer, right? You think that's something anybody can just jump into and see what's going on. This literally just got posted by a little business up in a place that I'm pretty fond of that I like to go. It's a little legendary Western town, as they like to call themselves, and you may know of it as well. Aurora, Texas.
Yeah.
Right. And so they have a little fun little story, and they've got a whole show on that, of course. Won't really go too far into that. If you're interested in Aurora, great documentary that I got to make and help put together with my buddy Jim Mars on the Vortex channel. But it's the number one video on there for some reason. But anyway, so the town is super small. They don't really have a lot of businesses. But just in the last year, they've opened up some shops and little places right next to their little crash site area. So the whole story is a UFO crashed, and the alien body that was recovered was buried in the local cemetery. That's kind of the fun story. It's 1897, yeah. So before modern aviation. So the town likes to kind of incorporate that theme into their businesses. So they have this place called Area 114, which is because it's right off of the highway that it's next to. It's Highway 114. So yep. Area 114 is kind of a little shopping center. So they've got Martian margaritas, smoking windmill barbecue. So I'm kind of throwing a plug for these guys because they don't have hardly any notice out there in the world, but they just came out with this new custom ale.
Ooh.
That was super cool, and it's brand new.
Ooh.
Because they put it together. I'm going to see the picture of it. They just posted this on their Instagram, brand new. Everyone seeing this will be like some of the first people to ever see it. Oh. And that's the picture. I just sent it over to you on our Skype call here. And
yeah,
if you want to post that for your page or
I will most definitely make sure that because, ends up in the episode. Oh, my God, yes. That is epic. I love it. Oh, my God, that is too cool.
So we've got some alien ale for all the dudes and beer listeners out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean... it's something that has become pervasive in our society. The more studies you read, things like that, now more people are willing to accept the fact that there is probably intelligence outside of our sphere that we live in. But like we were saying, that does not necessarily mean that this technology comes from there. It could be coming from parallel dimension. It could be coming just from straight up high hardcore advanced work.
Right. And one thing I want to mention on that is that there's a whole, a lot of people have heard about more of the UAP studies going on. UAP is unidentified aerial phenomenon. And this is a sort of the nomenclature used in official documentation a lot of times so as to not stumble upon the undoing and the pop culture baggage of the term UFO. And you see it a lot in UK documents. Nick Pope, who I've met with on several occasions, discusses this when he was at the Ministry of Defense in the UK. You've got a lot of people I've gotten with John Alexander, who was part of the Department of Defense here in the US, who's done a number of studies outside of just the UFO phenomenon, but looking into psi phenomena as well, psychic phenomena, remote viewing. There's so much we could go into this rabbit hole forever, but one thing I wanted to mention is kind of along the lines of what you just said. A big instance that came out about the recent UAP revealing, as far as the investigation thereof and the main encounters by the Navy, some people have probably heard of the Nimitz encounter or the Tic Tac UFOs. The latest ones that have kind of come out on the news everywhere are about those instances with the Navy. So I'll just say this briefly, that I was able to meet with, and this the whole Tic Tac UFO incident basically is this. In 2004, so about 16 years ago by now, you've got this aircraft carrier, the Nimitz, along with the battle formation around it, which had a USS Princeton small boy, which is a much smaller vessel than the aircraft carrier, only about 400 people, whereas the aircraft carrier had about 5,000. They were doing a routine war game exercise out off the coast of California and going out, about 100 miles from there and just doing routine things. I got to meet with three people who were aboard the Princeton and one person who was aboard the Nimitz. Essentially what had happened was the primary person I think that I got to interact with was Kevin Day, who was the radar operator.
Mm.
And these things pop up, and it's not your conventional radar like you'd see in the movies with a, you know, sonar type thing. It's very sophisticated. And so they had these blips, or otherwise these unknowns, these targets pop up. And they thought, maybe this is a glitch. Maybe the system's kind of malfunctioning. Let's reboot. And this is not really something that's just a flip at the switch. It takes a while. And so eventually when it started up again, they were all still there. They still had all of these unknowns, these targets that were unknown to being displayed on their presentation. And they said, well, that must mean that this wasn't. And so we need to go intercept whatever's out there, figure out what's going on, because they're moving and they are uniform and there's something going on. So this guy, Kevin Day, again, he's a senior radar operator for the Princeton, basically launches up the F-18 Hornets, of which Commander David Fravor was aboard. And who you can hear about on like the Joe Rogan podcast. And he was probably one of the main people on the news too. Basically, he goes up there and has physical confirmation of the object. And they're called Tic Tacs because they physically looked like a big Tic Tac, or maybe not enormous, but about the size of an 18 wheeler or so. And at the bottom, they have these two little hockey stick shaped prongs coming out. And, you know, these guys were screaming through the air. And they said these Tic Tacs would just ever so slightly just move out of the way and just incredibly implausible speeds just move in a way that was non-conventional. Anyway, I never got to meet and talk with Fravor, the pilot, but everyone else that I talked to was aboard the Princeton and saw the footage, which was crisp HD footage, unlike what we were publicly presented with a really blurry looking blob that everyone's like, that's a jet, that's not anything. And it's like, well, we're looking at some really bad quality doctored footage that for whatever reason we don't have access to the originals. So that was they're attempting to subpoena that and get it out anyway. So I want to just give a shout out to those guys, Kevin Day. You've got
absolutely
Gary Voorhees, Jason Turner, and so all of these are on the channel. You can listen to these interviews, and PJ Hughes as well. PJ was on the Nimitz. So you've got three guys on the Princeton, one guy on the Nimitz.
And there was so much of that. Like, that was just, go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's cool. I just was mentioning this because it, not only is it a prevalent and modern UFO or UAP case that was conducted, by the Navy, at least as far as attempting to intercept whatever these objects were. And then, this was a big deal in the media a few years back. So the point of I'm making about this is that not only is this an important case and go check it out and watch the videos, that's whatever. My point is that every one of those people that I talked to, which you can see in the videos, they, and again, this comes back to our point about discernment. Every one of those guys says that's not any kind of technology that we have that I know of. And it doesn't definitely seem like it was made by people or humans. Now, every one of those guys, all four of them, kind of alluded to something like that. Doesn't necessarily mean that just because they thought so or that was their opinion, that that's actually the case. So, it could be, like you said, maybe they were drones. Maybe they were being operated by humans somewhere. Maybe they were AI. Maybe they were developed by some kind of Skunkworks-esque super private company. It's something that we don't really know. And to say they're alien or ET simply just because they don't seem conventional,
it puts a myopic view.
It's kind of a typical thing,
Yeah.
So I just thought I'd share the notion that all of those guys, all those decorated veterans, were like, that was not us for sure. And so that's pretty convincing, but it doesn't mean that that's the truth. We don't.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things. Even though someone could be highly decorated, doesn't mean that they know all the answers either.
That's right. And just because the Navy doesn't know doesn't mean it isn't an Air Force project. It was really strange that Air Force personnel came aboard a Navy carrier and came and took data.
That was very peculiar.
Yeah.
That right after that happened, you have Air Force coming aboard a Navy ship.
Precisely.
To take the data tapes. And that was something that PJ talks about because he was aboard the Nimitz. And those other guys didn't know about that. They heard about it later.
Yeah.
And so they all corroborate each other's stories. And I even jokingly, I make light of it because, during, just like, I'm sure you have some fun things you say to the people you interview and talk to, not necessarily because you're curious, but because you know that there are people out there who would want to ask these types of things. So I would say to them, you know, so it's not like you guys got together and concocted this crazy story about Tic Tac. And they're like, you know, and I'm like, I'm only asking you this because this is something that you know people out there are going to be like, oh, those guys, they spent too much time out in the sea and, you know, it's scuttlebutt and all this stuff. And, you know, so it's like, you just have fun with it. But also, it's a very serious thing to show that these guys did not just like get together to collaborate this weird story.
It's not some flyboy hoax, you know. And I mean, right here, I've got it coming up from National Interest. And I know that at one point I had it from Jane's Defense Weekly. I'd have to find it again, but they're all of 2 years ago. They released the fact that the military was creating technology where drones could be controlled via thought. And that was 2 or 3 years ago. That this stuff was and when Jane's Defense Weekly is talking about it, that means like, hey, guess what's coming up at the next weapons con, folks? Guess what's getting ready to be released by contractors? So
and it makes you wonder, was this, you know, was someone privy to their Navy exercise with their battle formation and said, you know what, let's add some fun to their game.
Exactly. That is precisely what me and security expert and investigator Mike Turber have said every single time he's been on, is that the reaction of them is not because, hey, man, if something came in and interrupted your airspace and did not respond to your request or command in the middle of a military exercise, do you really think that they would not send at least one armed escort? One.
Right. And what they the thing is that, you know, maybe you have to imagine that whoever, let's consider the possibility that these are being manufactured somewhere here by someone other than some, you know, humans, let's just put it that way.
Sure.
But just very cryptically, let's go with that for a moment. Let's say that if they're able to do that, then they probably have, you know, the golden check, you know, like unlimited resources.
Oh,
so
sure.
Losing one at the expense, you have what are called affordable losses. It's likely that they could have thrown out the beta models and said, you know what, we've got a few throwaway ones that even if they went all out and actually did some damage, it wouldn't even matter. Because those are the beta models. We have, you know, they're just the prototypes. We have stuff way beyond maybe even those that allows us to just send those out to just use as throwaway experimental, you know, encounters to see, like you said, to see how a response would be against conventional or otherwise
precisely
what we think is super, super high tech stuff. Like we think the F-18 Hornet is like next to the 35 and capabilities of, you know, I think it's retired in some places now, but it's like, we like to consider that those ballistic types of technologies are like up there at our best. So to say that, you know, these, whoever is sending out these Tic Tacs, at least at that instance, I would think probably wouldn't send out their top of the line, like, you know, billion-plus dollar projects and saying, you know what, we'll just see what happens, because if you lose it, then it's like, well, what is
precisely
the whole point?
Now what, it's over enemy soil when it gets lost, you know?
Right. And that's one of the big things. I want to mention this because you just said something that just reminded me. So people can say whatever about this figure, whether they believe him or don't believe him is regardless.
Sure.
I want to just make a mention to it. Someone I got to meet last year, Sergeant Clifford Stone, retired veteran who basically was a part of these programs who went out to do crash retrievals. And one of the things he mentioned was, you know, even aside from the whole ET craft crashes and things like that, that even very conventional yet secret at the time, unconventional projects like the stealth bomber, I'll have to go back and see. I've got this, it's like an hour and a half long interview with him.
Yeah.
Not on there yet. It's definitely something I want to share for you guys once I get it up.
Definitely.
He talks about how he had to go out, and I don't have to think about which country it was. He had to go out to a site where a stealth bomber had crashed, and they had to do cleanup so as to not let anyone else get the technology of the stealth bomber, even though it wasn't like, that's important now, of course, but it wasn't like an alien craft. It was just something that they had that was super high tech and secretive. So even right there, we know that that's something that has potentially happened with even conventional craft. And so that's a good point you made, is we don't want to leave it over enemy territory to where they can go and reverse engineer it and get it. And I think that's probably one of the ways that something like the Nazis originally got hold of some of their understanding of the technology, which eventually translated over into Project Paperclip, which is where the Nazi scientists were brought over from Germany into the Americas, and or, you know, America specifically. And then, of course, we have NASA, and NASA's rocket program is a German rocket program. You know, it's like people don't realize that. Wernher von Braun, you know, all of those scientists worked for the Nazis. They knew something. They figured something out to be able to get to the point to where they did, whether it was organically done just through great scientific developments or
inspired. Whether it be inspired through contact, as some propose, inspired through reverse engineering, even possibly inspired by previous civilizations on Earth. Like what is described as the Vimanas in Sanskrit text, things like that, where quite literally they did find torsion engines that the Nazis were working on. They were working on concepts like the Bell, and you know, I mean, when I told my wife that that I was going to be getting some mercury to spin around and electrify, she was like, "Can we wait until we get the house? Can we wait until you like have your own barn to do that in?"
Because awesome.
You know, hey, let's just see what happens. Why not? I have the means.
You know, I want to. I'm going to see if I can locate another picture here. I'm going to send you, because you remind me of something that we didn't really touch upon, but I think is important to note in the case of ufology here, which is the Cash Landrum incident.
Oh, yeah.
Of 1980. And it's crazy because, you know, it coincides. If there's no direct connection to, that's fine. But it is kind of peculiar that the Cash Landrum incident, which is also in Texas, kind of closer to where you are than me
in
at the
Dayton.
Moment, but I've
in Dayton, like I grew up spending time in Dayton. Like my dad is from Dayton, so I spent summers there. Like I grew up hearing about that stuff.
The whole, not to get into that one too deeply, of course, and like all of these things, but the whole Cash Landrum incident, the name is based upon the two ladies.
Yeah.
Who were driving a vehicle, one with their grandson, down that. And I'm going to send you the picture because I've been right there on that road. Of course, it's totally different.
Yeah.
It's not the same. But the whole point is that they heard a bunch of helicopters, which sounded like thunder. And then they saw this diamond shaped glowing object descend upon the road, which apparently seems to be in distress. You've got like 24 black double rotor military helicopters, like obviously not like UFO in the sense of like discs or whatever. These are obvious helicopters, no question about it. And then this glowing diamond that's descending and then, you know, sputtering and has fire, flames or light kind of shooting out the bottom and like I would think kind of melting the road away at that point with the radiation. They got a little bit too close, they got irradiated, the thing kind of flew away. But basically the next day they were super sick, hair falling out, everything, you know.
So yeah, physical burns on their skin. Like they are some of the true experiencers out there in the world of, you know, third degree contact.
Yeah, I think that it's a really important case to look at. And of course here in Texas, it's you know, an interesting thing to go and see if you can. We had a meetup out there a few years ago at a private group that was going to go out there. And
you still there? Uh-oh. Did we just lose Daniel?
Yep, still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Are you still there?
Okay. Yeah, I think I got a notification there.
Oh, okay, okay.
Switch over, see if you can still hear me okay really quick.
Oh, no, I'm still good.
All right, how's this?
Perfect, perfect. Don't worry. Okay. I thought we had an Art Bell moment for a second there. I was like, wow, we aren't even getting hardcore. We're like talking Cash Landrum. This has been in newspapers since like 75. What the hell?
Right. Like, well, you know, it could happen. But just with some of those things like that, it was really weird. We had a meetup out there just to go and go kind of retrace their steps of where they went that night and just kind of do an in-person tour. And while we were there, they had a sign that was, you know, saying this is where we're meeting, kind of our get-together location. And someone pulled up. It was a private property. And someone pulled up and said, I can't stay. I'm on my way to do whatever I have to go. But I just wanted to let you know that I remember that night. I remember seeing the helicopters, and it absolutely did happen. And I just wanted to let you know. So, all right, see you later. And they drove off.
Wow.
And so, you know, there are still people out there who recall that, who knew that there were helicopters. And anyway, I just wanted to mention that it happened within 24 hours of probably the most well-known UFO incident within the UK, which is the Rendlesham Forest case, that happened within the same exact time frame. Now, I'm not suggesting that there's any direct connection there. It's just very odd that that would have both happened literally like at the same time, almost within the same day. The Rendlesham Forest incident is where an object or some lights had been seen over a number of days in December of 1980. And on the final day, the military personnel who went to go investigate, who I have met, Jim Peniston and Colonel Charles Halt, they went out there, or at least Peniston did. Halt saw something different. Peniston touched the object that they had seen, which apparently touched down on the ground, and he received binary code imprinted within his mind. Now, this all sounds very bizarre, but what's really interesting is that my buddy Nick Redfern, good man originally from England, of course, who now resides in Texas, he has written a book on the Rendlesham Forest incident that is, I would say, you know, to most probably controversial, but very outstanding, because it talks about things. It opens up the doors to alternatives that most ufologists generally probably, even, you know, the ufologist wouldn't necessarily immediately come, to agreement with because of the shared narrative of the story, at least as far as we know it. So there's a lot more to these cases that we just maybe, you know, haven't heard about because certain information, certain sources, people who haven't come forward.
Well, and,
you know, there's a lot out there to glean from even these old and historical cases.
Absolutely, because like we were saying, number one, people hesitate to come forward. Many people come forward in their deathbed confession. Many people come forward like 5-10 years before they're gone to a family member, things like that. And not only that, but these things are so glazed over that most people typically consider the fact of, if I said anything, nobody would believe me anyway.
Right. And I think it's also kind of along the lines of, even someone saying it, and this is a good example that was mentioned. There was a great panel that Grant Cameron, Rich Dolan, and my buddy Danny Silva, Joe Mergia, Melinda Leslie, a lot of these guys were a part of just the other day as the Wilson leak panel. And they could probably have had a dozen more people on there that could have helped, you know, to share just small little side stories or aspects overall, but the kind of good specialists I think were on board with that. Anyway, there was something that they had inquired upon through Kit Green, another very preeminent scientist who covers, like, you know, kind of paranormal topics through the government's research. And Kit Green was asked about the Wilson memo. He said, look, regardless of whether I comment, have an opinion on it, know about its existence or whatever, should be totally irrelevant. And that's one of those interesting things that, you know, even though someone can have like an idea or something like that, would it even matter? And to them, I guess, anyway, whether they share about it or not. So you can only imagine things that have been never revealed, that have been taken to the grave. And I always like to think that there are things out there that we'll never know, unfortunately, about all of history, because either deterioration, loss of integrity of information, just dissolution of certain organizations, all of these things which could lead to the total loss of otherwise like invaluable things. You've probably heard about the stories of the Smithsonian allegedly destroying like the remains of giants and skeletal remains. That's a great example of a story that
possible
which likely is a fabricated news story, but might actually have some validity to, you know, something having happened of that sort. Whoa. And I feel like that's probably the case, which is a whole other area I'm fascinated with, and is the concept of forbidden archaeology and and things of that such. So
same. Yeah, whenever you're talking about things like the lost city that was found inside of the Grand Canyon, and notated like prominently in an article, so much so that the Smithsonian sent people out to it.
Yeah, and I know which one you're talking about because I got to. it's really neat. I that event that I kind of got to meet some of these people at last year was out in Laughlin, Nevada.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I drove out there because I wanted to go drive through, you know, West Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and just stop it anywhere I could. It's beautiful. I'd love to be able to get out there. But I made my first trip coming back to the Grand Canyon, and I did a little segment on that and how – like you said, it was mentioned in an article, and they had someone from the Smithsonian come out to investigate. And of course, the area, the entrance of this explorer basically was inaccessible, and no one can get there now. And it's you know, totally blocked off. I think that, you know, there are definitely areas that, you know, public areas that you can go to, and then those which you can't. And then of course, places that if anything were to have been found. And again, this is all about, it's almost like Planck's principle, except in regard to classification in government.
Yeah.
Which Planck's principle, again, is just, you know, scientists have certain ideologies, and that sets the standard for certain scientific realms, but they kind of maintain that integrity until those scientists literally die off. And then maybe there's new breath, new life for different ideas.
Yeah,
maybe
hopefully some of
that for government and government military people who mark this stuff so high above top secret that, you know, for no other reason than just for whatever they think, that, you know, it's going to be that way until either they're gone or those, you know, certain authorities are in different positions to make declassifications.
Yeah.
I think that it's hard to call, like, you know, back then, which I think that was in the early 1900s when they made those alleged discoveries. But yeah, same thing. It's like, how can you go in there and say, oh, well, we've got Egyptian artifacts and mummies and Buddha statues, and I guess we can just share with the world that we've got a new tourist attraction. Well, come check it out. You know, I think that would have been the other extremity, you know.
Just the extreme fact of, hey, guess what, folks? The president is not a need-to-know employee.
Right.
He is, believe it or not, a temporary government employee. He may not have security clearances for certain things, even though he's the president.
Yeah, exactly.
And, like, has a dude with the football three steps behind him at all times. He may not have the security clearance for certain things and for certain projects.
Yeah, so to me, you know, that's another big area is the archaeological findings that have been very controversial.
Yeah.
And not just, you know, not just basic things about modern history, but ancient history and also ancient culture that in a totally different than the mainstream narrative that we're given. A good example would be, you know, like you're bringing up of the Grand Canyon mysteries. I'm going to share a little clip that I did on that with you guys, because it's something I think is just fun to be able to see that, you know, there are sources out there that can show us maybe there's something to it, whether we're actually going to be able, you know, tangibly able to go explore it as civilians. I don't know, but maybe we can just do what we can to get as close as we can and contribute what we can. That the challenge is, as citizen scientists and citizen journalists, is that we don't muddy up the waters too much for those who are making the official call, because the last thing you need is some bozo or whoever to go out there thinking they know what they're doing, like me, and then say, this is what it is. And then, you know, and then the scientists come out there and say, you're a nutcase. And
you're a crazy person right now. Get out of here.
So, you know, and maybe they're right. Maybe that's what it actually is. I mean, that's the whole concept of Stargate. the show anyway, is that, you know, Daniel Jackson had this premise. He's the scientist. He thought, well, maybe they were using this technology to travel amongst the stars. And then they find out, yep, we made this discovery, and it turns out you're right. So we're going to basically take you and induct you into our program so you can help us figure this out. So, you know, I think that actually probably is based a bit in reality in some sense, because you have some of these things which I think lend credence to those concepts, which we otherwise just think, oh, that's just Hollywood. Those are just movies, like you were saying earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like it's utter science fiction, but at the same time, good Lord, like these people they have consultants. They have people in the know scientifically.
Not like everyone up there is a specialist and basically running all of the different disciplines. I think you have to have your interdisciplinary folks, and then you have to have people who definitely know their stuff in that particular discipline.
Most definitely.
Because otherwise you can't have one guy who's just at the head of everything, knowing everything. And maybe some places, some groups do, but I think it's important that you have your specialists who contribute, you know, maybe anthropologically, maybe geologically, and in those different ways. And they say, okay, well, you're showing us this and that. And then you have the overseers who say, well, based upon the conclusions of all of these scientists and specialists, it would seem to go into effect that this was the case. And then you very matter of fact, you know, try to make sense of what you were finding. Well, one interesting archaeological site that I found last year that I've heard about, and you might have heard about this as well, for anyone such as yourself who's followed along with some of these great mysterious artifacts and you know, findings, you have what are called ooparts, which are the out of place artifacts.
Yep.
And these are things that, you know, are conventionally overturning known archaeological time frames and basically not found in places that they should be, or can, you know, in the right timelines, and it doesn't make sense.
Things like things like the fire pits and pottery that they find in Pennsylvania and stuff that's like 10,000 years, you know.
Exactly. Well, that's just the idea, because, you know, if you think about it, you've got the Minnesota Vikings.
Yes. Which
no one really thinks, well, why are they called that? Well, it's because they found
Viking artifacts
of Vikings and things. And even that's not very – that's still pretty conventional. You know, we're okay with accepting that. But when you start finding things like, you know, Greek and Roman artifacts and Chinese and
Venetian
artifacts, it totally overthrows what we think that, you know, has been happening. And so the consensus seems to be amongst academia is that we don't have a transoceanic civilization ever having been around. The irony in all of that is that you look at some of the things found in deep in the Amazonian cultures within South America, Central America, and even here in America, and you see things that, again, are filtered out because they just don't seem right. Rather than saying, okay, well, let's just see what it is, because this is what we're finding, we a lot of times in scientific domain say, well, this can't be, because our model says that this is impossible, so we're just going to not acknowledge it and totally ignore it. Unfortunately, it happens probably more than we realize. And
we're going to set this anomaly aside because it's an anomaly.
Right.
Not research why the anomaly happened, just it's an anomaly. So move on.
You have a lot of those anomalies, and I think it goes, like you said, very, very far back. One person who I've greatly admired for years now and had the honor and fortune of meeting was Graham Hancock. He's done incredible work on just sort of the alternative historical notions that, you know, maybe there's a lot more to what we realize in these antediluvian ancient civilizations.
Yeah.
And he's got a great new book came out with last year called America Before, which shows that, you know, there are modern people in the Americas as far back as maybe even 100,000 years, which 50,000 to 100,000 years, which totally overthrows everything we know.
Yep.
Especially to find out that things like the Amazon is not just for the most part, a natural organic occurrence, but was a seeded environment by an ancient culture of which you can maybe still find the remains of their enormous cities deep riddled deep within the Amazon. And I think that's such a fascinating concept to think that, you know, there could still be a way for us to find it. And I'm thinking, you know, we'll probably have to rely more on those computer assisted and AI assisted technologies to look down, use satellite imagery and then find signatures.
The stuff that they're doing with drone, with LIDAR on drones, things like that. Right now, I actually want to play that clip that you were talking about from the Grand Canyon. This is Daniel Allen Jones from the Vortex out there at the Grand Canyon talking about ancient civilizations.
Greetings and welcome to the Vortex. I'm your host, Daniel Allen Jones, and we are here at a very special location, the Grand Canyon. The National Park is now celebrating 100 years of bringing in people from all over the world that like to be able to come and see this amazing natural phenomenon that still puzzles people and scientists as to how this place was formed. There are a lot of interesting places that native tribes have emerged from over the last several centuries, and even special artifacts that have been discovered that go back several millennia. While there are many mysteries still waiting to be discovered here at the Grand Canyon, one particularly fascinating story, which dates back to 1909, comes from the Arizona Gazette, which is no longer in publication. This deals with a story of two men, Kincaid and Jordan, who allegedly were going down Marble Canyon. G.E. Kincaid's account deals with the discovery of what he thought was an old mine shaft, which he says turned out to be a cave entrance, which went into the canyon and found an enormous structure inside with statues which resembled Buddha, but also the remains of what seemed to be Egyptian type mummies and Eastern artifacts, which would have dated back several thousands of years. Of course, newspapers and publications at the time dealt a lot with the different stories that seemed to be hoaxes and turned out to be false or just were used to sell newspapers in old tabloids. But there may be something to this story as it's been looked into by independent researchers over the years.
Yeah, and, you know, there it is right there, just and some beautiful stuff, actually, some great footage there, Daniel. But just thinking about the fact that, yeah, there are things like that out there. There are sites like that. There are discoveries like that that have been made.
You know, one thing I just want to mention at the very beginning, I call it a natural phenomenon. Of course, that's pretty much any conventional website you go into is going to say that. But there are actual ideas out there that consider that maybe it's not natural, or at least maybe a portion of it is not natural and it was made in some way. And that's pretty incredible to fathom, that maybe something out there helped to construct that geological formation in some way, maybe whether we can comprehend it or not. There's some interesting research to show that maybe something helped form it, or maybe something with water. So while I just say that at the beginning for the sake of, you know, where we are, it could be something totally different than we realize.
That's right. There's nothing to say that there weren't builders like there were at Tanis that came in, found a naturally existing cave and went, hey, let's excavate this thing and make it a whole lot bigger. So it's and to discount that, you know, and kind of even as we've said numerous times on this show, even to discount the fact that people made the pyramids. What if people just made them?
Right. I think that, you know, a lot of the things that we consider to be incredibly sophisticated could have been done through means that we just haven't really explored in a way that's going to be, you know, well known. And I think you look at a place like over in Florida, Coral Castle.
Yes.
And I've been there, but that's a good example of someone who, within modern times, with very readily available things and technologies, was able to move incredibly heavy stones and things like that without a whole lot of effort. And I'm not saying necessarily that that's our answer or our explanation, but it shows us that there's more than we realize that could have been utilized and could have been done to make those things happen.
That's
and
right.
Yeah, I think that's a good point you're making, Chris, on some of these things. Maybe it was us. And I think that we sometimes diminish our own ability at incredible feats of engineering and things like that.
Well, you know, especially whenever you start going into the historic past and you start looking at people like Archimedes, you know, like, good God, man, that dude was like the Thomas Edison of prehistory.
Right.
Like, like there wasn't a thing like, oh, yeah, you need some water to get to your town from, you know, down the road. No problem. We'll put a screw in the water and just have it bring it up for you. like it was just phenomenal. The general engineering principles that he came up with, even
right.
to know that in the time of ancient Greece that they had automatons, they had all that kind of technology.
Even like the, you know, we're talking about Uparts, you know, the Antikythera mechanism, which is like ancient
yep.
computer that
yeah.
they just now recently kind of figured out, what it did.
Yeah, yeah, that it was basically a big clock that was used to, I think it's the Olympic Games, is that right?
I think something to do with circumnavigation and seafaring.
Okay.
I think
maybe one of the earlier theories about it was the fact that it was a way to calculate that like every country had one that was set to their own place.
But I think so, because you have to imagine, why would there just be one? And
yeah.
if there were only one, you know, why would it have been so easily susceptible to, you know, being lost? Like
yeah.
That?
Yeah.
Precisely. Well, I mean, not to say that's impossible. Of course, things like that could happen, which are terribly unfortunate. You can imagine the disappointment of having invented something, and then finally you're about to showcase it, and then it sinks on a boat. And
yeah,
then,
man.
Goes up to the presentation. You say, "Well,
what happened to the prototype?" Well, the boat's a funny story.
Yeah,
we're on the way over there, right? We got our visas, we got all the clearances to get into the docks. Be damned if the boat didn't sink.
So, you know, sure, some of those things probably have happened, but what's the likeliness that it was just that one? You know, I think that, like you said, it could have been used to calculate it, so many things. And
sure.
that's the idea that could have been just like the prototype or the beta version of
something.
Yeah,
like the original slide rule.
Way more accurate.
Yeah. And
so,
go ahead.
I was just saying, and so you can see that some of these technologies that we're finding, you know, it's hard to say that maybe there was just that one. And same thing with all these, you know, creatures that we're encountering. How is it that there can only be just this one? So
yeah.
the singular aspect of a lot of these encounters, findings, sightings, all this stuff is very elusive. But also, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean it's all related in the same way. I just think that the process of our own investigation, both as an individual with our current frame of minds, and as a collective society and our societal point of view and how we interpret those findings, because you look back at the cultural relevance of the Romans, and if they had seen UFOs, they were flying shields because shields were culturally relevant to them.
Yeah.
Whereas they're really not to us now, but, you know, even further back, you have flying chariots and chariots on fire.
And
we don't have chariots. We have cars, but we don't say they're flying cars.
In 85, they look like DeLoreans.
Right.
You know? but yeah, it really is the fact of you have to look at it through the culture through which it's being filtered, through the time in which it's being filtered, all of that.
Yeah, I want to mention, as we're on this topic here, because it has to do with that whole concept of something that we're kind of under the impression of as a society, because this is something that, you know, we might read in textbooks, and science tells us this, history tells us that. We think, again, that, you know, transoceanic, transatlantic travel was non-existent. But something along the lines that might be more modern, maybe not like tens of thousands of years, but maybe within the last 1,000 to 2,000 years, more like within the biblical range of time.
Mm-hmm.
Something that I've found I thought was pretty interesting is something called the Las Lunas Mystery Stone. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but I heard stories over the years of a particular stone that was found in New Mexico out in the desert, kind of like in the middle of nowhere, that basically was alleged to have had inscription upon it, which was some kind of Greek or biblical scripture or writing.
Yes.
Engraved
yes.
upon the stone. And so I had been curious about this for a while. I was thought, you know, I can look into it, try to study what I can find on the internet. And that's always one passageway to information. But there's nothing like trying to figure out where something like that actually is, if it's accessible. And if so, what can we do to make sense of, you know, like we were talking about earlier, I'm not a scientist. I'm not an archaeologist.
Yeah, you're just a dude.
Who's going out to figure out what I can figure out myself. Maybe if there's something I can share and contribute,
yep.
then let's do it. But, you know, in my doing so, it's just out of my own invested investment. And so I think that if I see things this way, if I'm able to do that, then, you know, there've got to be people who have funding, have grants, who've got government-backed teams, in military, you know, all of this stuff to figure these things out. And so I'm thinking if the little I can do has led me to these incredible synchronicities and otherwise sort of surreal things and encounters, there's probably people with much more efficient resources out there who are really doing this under the radar, you know, off the record, so to speak. So to me, it's something that I thought, this is interesting. So
yes.
Getting back to it, the Las Lunas Mystery Stone.
Also known as the Decalogue Stone.
Right, right. And this is and the more you kind of get into it, you see kind of why.
Yeah.
And it's kind of strange because this story basically deals with the potential of an ancient Hebraic peoples, which may have traveled over from, you know, the Middle East and reached their way over into the Americas some 2,000 to 2,500 years ago. Of course, no historian is going to tell you that happened.
Yeah.
And if you tell them that, they're going to say that's rubbish, that's nonsense, you know.
Okay.
And so,
yeah, what 2,000-year-old things are you smoking?
Right. And so I read into it. I looked to see, you know, where there were any leads. I found a few videos, pretty rough videos on YouTube about it. And most of the people, and not to throw flack, I think it's great that people are looking into these from whatever angle it is, but most of the videos and sites I found on it were pretty religiously oriented,
skewed, yeah.
Which is fine because it's a religious sort of artifact, I guess, if anything. The whole point was that it suggested that a group of Hebrews went over to the Americas, made a settlement, and decided to write the Ten Commandments, or at least an abbreviation of them, onto this stone.
Yeah,
and
one of the,
you know,
lost tribes of Israel.
And it very well could be, you know, and you know, you talk about the Decalogue. Well, Deca is 10, so 10 Commandments, the Decalogue stone. That's why we call it that, apparently. And so I realized that not only was there the stone, but and it's kind of sloped down sideways at about a 45-degree angle. And when you're reading ancient Hebrew, or in this case, Paleo Hebrew, you read right to left, not left to right. And so, however this happened, the stone seems to have fallen, or maybe it was written this way, I don't know. And it's at sort of the closer to the base of this mountain they call Hidden Mountain. Apparently the natives, or what we seem to call natives, referred to this mountain as, and they were the Isleta natives, by the way, the Isleta Indians or natives, called this the Hidden Mountain and or the Cliff of Strange Writings. So it's interesting to consider the people we refer to as natives as not actually being native, because they all came from maybe somewhere else, and maybe that they're actually descendants of these Hebrew people, and that our history is so convoluted that we just don't even know that. And in researching this, I realized that there's so many indications to show that, and you can't blanket state natives because there's so many different cultures and subcultures. So not to, you know, be misappropriating any group of natives particularly, but it shows that some native cultures seem to have great resemblance to ancient Hebrew culture.
Yep.
Out of rites, out of ceremony, out of language, out of many things that would potentially show that they could have been long lost relatives or ancestors, because maybe passing down culture over a few generations, it gets a little bit mixed up. Not really too sure what some things are, but, you know, most things could be intact. Yeah. And there's some interesting things about this. I'm going to send you the picture that I took. I found the stone. I located it myself. This was kind of a crazy journey because I using the videos and the sources of information that I found, there was nothing clear as to go this way, take this way, follow this. And it was almost very anecdotal or ambiguous as to like immediate directions. There's no GPS way to do it. But I found it and I was fortunate enough to locate it. I just sent you the picture there. You're welcome to post it. And you can see, I'll show you a blown up one of the stone. It looks hard to tell in there, but it's inscribed with
Aleph
and all those sort of Greek Hebrew letters.
Yeah, it almost looks like a Rosetta Stone in its own right. And I've had it up on screen for the last little bit since we've been talking, nice and zoomed in so that people could actively see it. It's a absolutely phenomenal piece of work. From what I know, once I saw a picture of it, I was like, I know exactly what he's talking about.
Cool. Yeah, not a lot of people do, but I figured, you know, if you're into a lot of these things, you might have at least got a hint of it. And then, you just threw out Decalogue right off the bat, so I knew exactly.
As soon as I saw it, it was like, the Lost Tribe of Israel. Okay, because, there was a huge connection there with the Jehovah's Witnesses. Their whole story about being a lost tribe of Israel, and being guided out there by Moriah, all kinds of stuff. So it's been tied in numerous different ways, even in the modern culture.
Well, that's the thing is I found most people, researchers or however that have approached it have done so from a religious standpoint again, which is fine. Mm. But you just don't have a lot of, at least, academic involvement to say or to say either way that this is authentic or it's not. You really just don't have that at all. And again, this kind of comes back to if a guy like me can just go out there and find it, who's keeping the preeminent archaeologists and specialists that can really make change and saying, look, guys, you know, this is real or no, this is not real. And, you know, I think that would be a definitive. It would be fine if someone said it's not real to me. It'd be a kind of a letdown for some, but I don't think that that's kind of the point. It's more along the lines of why is this still one of those strange mysteries that hasn't been addressed?
Yeah.
And there's the other picture of it kind of leveled out because it's like a 45 degree angle. It makes you wonder, was this somehow altered? Did something geologically affect the area to make that slope down and fall? That's the idea, is that up here on the mountain, I'm going to show you the rest because, you know, not a lot of people talk about the rest that you can see up there, but I don't know if these are modern. I for sure know that other people go there because I saw some footprints, and so maybe it's sort of like
I mean, there's home scratched into the rock behind you.
Oh, yeah, and of course, for anyone seeing it, people have known about the place for a long time. It wasn't until, I think, the 30s that some researcher who was very deeply involved with basically ancient Mesopotamian ruins and writings and studied Iraq culture, who came out there and said, look, you know, this is basically what my interpretation of it is. I'm pretty sure this is authentic. And the only thing I could think of that would set it apart would be maybe there were some settlers in the early centuries that somehow were still very strong and not wavering their integrity of like a certain purist tradition in the scope of like the Abrahamic faith Judaism, but just the Hebrew culture. So maybe, you know, maybe there are some people who just held on to that and went up there because, you know, if the natives knew about it, that's got to be at least 2, 3, 4 centuries old.
Yeah.
So maybe some people around the time of the Vikings came over, and even still, that's okay. That's cool. You know, I think that's not necessarily going to diminish the idea. It just needs to be acknowledged that something happened.
You got to be cool with it.
Right.
You know,
I think it's something we just have to not brush under the rug and say, because it doesn't make sense, let's just ignore it, like we do all these other things.
And it's interesting because my wife, Daniel, she's not a believer at heart with all this stuff. She's like, I don't think that people have the intelligence to be able to carry on a conspiracy for that damn long. That's her opinion. She's like, I don't think that the cooperation between people exists to be able to cooperate long enough to subvert something that long, which is an interesting perspective to have. But whenever we watch shows, like, good Lord, before I had Bingo Minerva on for Lost Gold, I watched both seasons back to back. Like, she was like, I've never seen you watch so much content for a show.
It's like sometimes we see those pictures of similarities between ancient cultures with their architecture, their structures, like pyramids. I mean, I think that there's definitely some telling signs that there was a cross-cultural connection. How that happened is the real mystery. But let's say even if there wasn't a direct connection, what had allowed these people to inorganic or just organically come up with almost the same thing verbatim?
Yeah.
And places we're told they never had any connection or direct communication or contact.
Yeah.
How would it have been that these people from all around, people who we are, that we're a part of, could have come up with all of these similar things without any hint of connection, in a way that it's like you could look at it and it's like going to a restaurant in one state and then going out of state and finding that restaurant in another place. It might have some different things on the wall, but it's that same restaurant.
Yeah. It's still a Red Lobster, bro. They're going to have cheese biscuits.
Right. And so, some of those things make us wonder, okay, let's, and again, it's one of those things like, what are all the possibilities? Let's say, for instance, maybe they literally had no direct contact. Mm-hmm. That widens the mystery even more, that maybe they had some kind of ability to tap into into their consciousness that allowed them a bit of information that other people were tapping into as well, that seemed to work for them. And it makes you wonder, okay, if we're really told that they didn't have any contact, then how is it that they came up with such similar forms of culture? Could there be another explanation? What would be the other alternative? And I think that even might be more curious than the idea. I mean, it's easy to say, well, yeah, they were all connected, and that's why.
How is it that Egyptian mummies have cocaine stuffed in them?
Yeah. Well, it might be a
coca leaves, I should say.
It could be a good way that we might find out how the pyramids got built so quick.
Right? But yeah, there are anomalies like this all over, and unless you're willing to put those explorations on the table, unless you're willing to be that bold dude in the room that is like, I don't know, I'm kind of thinking that the sun might be the middle of the solar system.
Right.
I'm kind of thinking we aren't the middle of the universe.
Yeah, I think that's it. And it makes you realize that there's so much we still have to understand about the basics of our reality. And it just sent you over this picture of, the Decalogue stone is interesting. You go on top of that mountain, and again, whether modern people made this even within the last 100 years or in the last 500 years, it's still kind of peculiar because you go on top of that mountain, and this is a panoramic, by the way, and there are stone structures up there. There are I guess what you could call hinges. A hinge is just a circle.
Yeah, it's an enclosure.
And it's like just kind of these little mini stone hinges up there. They're not like big monoliths, but they're a bunch of small plated sort of thin rocks stacked. And it's like, for what? What were people doing up here? And that the whole premise behind some of those stories, that this was a defense outpost, because you can see from every direction, and there was a nice river that led right up to it. And you could see one of my pictures is standing on the edge, and I'm looking out for miles, and it's like, this is 30 minutes away from Albuquerque. It's just bizarre to think, like, people are still going up there for, maybe it's kind of like people who go and for the different religious ceremonies around time of Easter and things, where people come and have like a a cave with a stone over it that they'll reveal to kind of emulate the resurrection and all these things where Jesus is reborn and those kinds of religious motives. I think that this could, you know, if not anything else, maybe this is just something like that where people come regularly on sort of these missions to, you know, reenact something that could have happened. I don't know, but I haven't gotten any kind of real indication that there's like a regular pilgrimage from locals to or whoever to go out there and check this place out. There's nothing that I've found that indicates that. Otherwise, I think we would have a better idea. Like, oh, well, those that Decalogue stone, that Las Lunas mystery stone, that's just, you know, it's just a place where these guys come and they kind of have a religious pilgrimage. And it's like, there's nothing unless it's on a super secretive society, you know, that just keeps to themselves, doesn't have a website or whatever. You know, that might make sense. You look at the Amish, you know, they don't really maybe have a lot of stuff that they openly share. So maybe it's like that. That would be my best, like, conventional explanation for something like this. Otherwise, who would take the time to go up on this super isolated mountain and make these stone circles that don't really have any seeming purpose?
And it's funny because the Decalogue stone, I've got the image up on our Facebook feed right now on the video. The image from ohiostate.edu shows everything. And then the image that you have has the top line of it, like, scratched out.
Yeah,
like,
okay. So
like,
that's,
apparently
that's
it said, like, Joni Loves Chachi, 1982, or something like that. You know,
well, that's
like, just some form of vandalism that happened on it.
Right, that apparently is the first one, basically like the first commandment, and I guess because someone thought that that was the most
heinous of all,
that maybe it should be scratched out, but for whatever reason, not the rest.
You Interesting.
See,
yeah,
there's a lot of little, you know, so and so was here, you know, heart this, whatever, and so people, yeah, people have been there for sure. I think it had more to do with like an anti-religious,
sure,
sort of you know, maybe motive in doing that. Otherwise, why leave all the rest defaced, I guess, if, as it were. Otherwise, the whole stone used to be black, like you see on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Someone must have come and power washed it down or something to get it to where the patina or whatever the growth on the stone that's sort of blackened has or would have otherwise covered up. So if someone had an eye, a keen enough eye to locate the writing, it's like an eighth of an indention into the stone. It's not just like a little scratch. It's in there. Definitely could do it with modern tools, but
yeah,
was it, you know, was it done that way?
Well, and that's something that I know people are still looking into as to the authenticity of the carvings themselves, which can be tough in some rites, as to whether or not that can be authenticated.
Yeah, I think the last time it was really looked into, I mentioned now there's not really enough archaeological scrutiny or you know, academic scrutiny on this. I think there was in the 50s, and then they dropped it because they just thought, oh, well, you know, it's not really a whole lot to it. But still, like, you know, what other place, and even just in America, have they settled on something 50 years ago and said, well, you know, should we look into this? Nah, don't even try. You know, like,
sorry,
we don't have to update our own records. No, just leave it as it is. I think that there's probably better cause to look at something like this than some of those things out there. So, you know, and then, like I said, if someone like me can just go find it based off of research and on the internet and talking to people, then I think there's great ways that can be done.
I found it because somebody geocached something underneath it, you know, like, like, quite literally.
There are arrows on rocks to be able to make it out there, so people know how to get there. Is there a collective pilgrimage by some unknown, or maybe not just unknown, but just some group who doesn't really share about their travel, you know, their attempt to go and, like, you know, reenact some kind of, I don't know, it just seems like, what's the point of going up there unless it was like a religious type of thing, you know, because some places do that. Some places have their sort of, you know, ceremonial rites of passage that are specific to their religious denomination or something. Yep. So I perfectly understand that. I just don't think that it makes sense for anyone else to go up there. There's not really anything to do or see or to check on. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of wildlife. I saw some look like eagles or hawks flying around. The elevation, I don't remember exactly at the moment. I think it's about 5,000, but that's probably off. But I mean, this is something I would be willing to really, I have a whole set of clips I'm working on that were just with this thing here. And I'd like to to publish a little piece on it just because there's not a lot out there. Maybe some websites and maybe videos. I don't think there's a book on it, which is fine, but any is just and I was actually there, and that there are other ideas about what it is. So that's fascinating to me because it's not super antique. You know, it's maybe 2,500 years old at the most, which that's cool. It's biblical, but it's not like one of those ancient, you know, 10,000 or tens of thousands of years.
Yeah, it's not like finding finding a Clovis spear point in the middle of Detroit, you know. And speaking of books, you actively have a book that you're in the middle of writing, things like that. Can you share a little bit about that with us before we let you go here at the end of the show?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So, and I'll just mention that along with some of the things I've talked about, it really does kind of bring it all into all-encompassing theory of everything, or TOE, as I like to put it, a sort of unified field theory dealing with universal principles, scientific concepts, future of technology and engineering, and mixing into it all these sort of mysterious subjects that we've been discussing all night. And so is the one that's going to be coming out here the soonest. I'd say I'm going to have to see about having that out before the fall, and it's called Mythos. And that stands for Mythical Operating System. And it mainly has to do with understanding the nature of reality, consciousness, advanced civilizations, things like simulation theory and the holographic principle.
Yeah.
Rigid and sometimes dense scientific concepts that I think are interesting, but also delving into those unknown mysteries, that those unexplained things that, you know, we're all looking at in a way that we wonder.
Right.
We're kind of hopeful. In some way we're hopeful, and in some way we're not. We like things to be mysterious because that's what gives it that unique quality. Once it's discovered, it sort of demystifies it. But that's the point of science sometimes, is we expand our awareness. So Mythos covers a lot of different things. Basically, it's twofold. Mythos is sort of a my version, or sort of a working model, scientific model of how we can interpret scales of reality, how we can interpret new discoveries, and then integrate those discoveries, or the information of those discoveries, into our society to set a new standard of understanding of our reality. Like we've been talking about, we need to learn from what we discover and then set a new standard. And then the other second half, I suppose you could dealing and addressing with all these other types of phenomena. And not to say it's giving answers, but it's addressing, okay, maybe we didn't think about this. Maybe it could be, it's really posing questions and asking about these things in a way that we didn't think about before. Where does cryptozoology fit in this? Where does ufology, where do advanced non-human intelligences fit into this?
Yeah.
Where do ancient artifacts, ancient civilizations, uparts, where does life after death fit in this? Where does consciousness, things that are fascinating to me, I think, we can at least attempt to apply a generalized overview of how they would be affected within these systems of reality, whether the system is a working worldview within our own individuated states of consciousness, or is it a collective group working within a world system, which would be like our world, embedded and nested within a greater system, i.e. the universe, or even before that, like the solar system, the galaxy, and the universe. So all of these systems and subsystems have properties which are detectable. And I posit many different things in the work. And essentially it's that, you know, once we attain a state of sophistication with AI, particularly, that many of these things will be known to us in such a way that it will revolutionize our understanding of the systems of reality in which we are embedded within, and the systems of which we are ourselves. and how we work within these systems and the information that we can interact with. So we would have something I refer, and I take a very philosophical approach, as that's probably the only, outside of being a musician, that's probably the only thing I can really say about myself and my background is as going, you know, in the field of academia. A big area focused in outside of music was philosophy, and a lot of things. But as a philosopher, I posit that much as Nick Bostrom does in his argument thesis, are we living in a computer simulation, that, well, it might not necessarily be a simulation of a computer as we think it is, but it's something that we can see, okay, these world systems and our own mental system and spiritual systems, whatever it is, these spiritual concepts are just simply forms of science that we haven't understood yet. And when we do, and we do detect those properties, we as agents within those systems will attain agent-to-agent communication or contact. Yeah. And the other agents could be animals, they could be advanced intelligences. And once we attain that correspondence with the other advanced agents, they will have already assuredly been able to detect these such properties, which they have utilized, no doubt, for their own purposes, such as, you know, engineering, whatever it is, exotic technologies appearing to us. And then, of course, what I like to say is the operator of the system, which, you know, some might refer to as God or sort of the administrator, whatever form that is. Not to say there's just one, because I think, you know, as far as how we see computer systems, you know, there can be several operators, and it could be a council, it could be a collective. So maybe our world system is governed by a collective of operators, which we may be able to have some interface with.
Well,
and until we do, you know, we'll see how that can affect our understanding. But I think for now, we're working through agent to agent interface.
Like I said earlier, we know the fact that we can control drones telepathically. That's already been shown, like government papers. We got it. There it is. These are systems that are out in place that can be used. I remember there was some stuff like that being integrated into the new YF-22 they were considering. But I just pulled up on screen a little while ago while you were talking the article from Fortune Magazine that I was mentioning pre-show, and I think I may have mentioned it earlier. A startup is using computer chips, or building computer chips using human neurons. And this is Cortical Labs out of Australia. But they are building a new generation of biological computer chips where we're a new biotech startup backed by Blackbird Ventures based in Melbourne, Australia. They are actively building silicon chips with human neurons inside of them.
Wow. Yeah, see, that's one of the bridging gap between some of those unknowns. And I think it's going of computer assistance, AI assistance.
Yeah.
Because, you know, once we have that happen, those programs or those forms of intelligence are going to probably have the, unless for whatever reason, and here's the other caveat, is unless we somehow develop the ability to do these things, or get, i.e., you know, some people say spiritually, however that is in our evolution, unless we can do that, which honestly seem to be, you know, maybe there are some people out there who have things, but aside from those things, it looks like our best opportunity at this point is going to be through AI assistance, which those forms of AI are going to learn a lot more about what's going on because of their ability to interpret the information at a much faster rate, which is going to be something like Moore's Law. Moore's Law states that processing power of computers and technology is going to exponentially grow every year, and even more so now that we have like different kinds of technologies and power processing. And so I want to, I'd like to share with you this article. Again, it's on the CIA's website, and it's pretty much, I think, a good bullet point of the theme, just the mere theme of what one of the topics I cover, the main topic, was because it has a lot to do with not just my own opinion. It's more about there's good reason to assess that these things may very well be the case, and here's why. And then I outline in all of those fields, backing them up with citation, how this could very well be the case. I'm going to send you this link here. And the CIA one, we can share that as well. I'm
gonna sure.
Send it. But it's basically going over all those scientific things we talked about. It's a PDF. I'm going to make sure I have the right one here. Because all right. This is the thing we talked about. Sometimes people, not if 404. Let me open it up.
Which one is it?
They're on to us now.
I wouldn't doubt it, my friend.
Now, there it is. Okay. It's not going to give you a very, very big thumbnail, but there have been some articles that link this PDF from the CIA. The main, I think, takeaway is a little write-up that says the universe is composed of interacting energy fields, at some at rest and some in motion, and it is in of itself one gigantic hologram of unbelievable complexity, according to theories of Carl Pirbrum, a neuroscientist at Stanford University, and David Bohm, a physicist at the University of London. The human mind is also a hologram which attunes itself to the universal hologram by the medium of energy exchange, thereby deducing meaning and achieving the state of which we call consciousness. So, you know, with that itself being embedded within a CIA document, I think for any skeptical person out there who doesn't really pay much attention to any of the, fly at night sort of websites that really don't have a whole lot of substance or substance at all. I mean, there's the CIA document.
I mean, they spent millions of dollars for decades and decades on programs like Stargate. The founder of SRI actively lives right here in Austin. He is a connection of mine. And I keep intending to get in touch with him and have him on to talk about that kind of work. To know that Carolyn Corey is out there with her new out there with her new documentary Superhuman, about these same things.
Her in person, and that one's coming down the line as well. So just to kind of put a cap on things coming out, I have dozens of those little interviews and clips that I'm going to be sharing on the Vortex. You guys are you're welcome, Chris, to share that on the page as well.
Oh, thank you.
And as far as the immediate book to come out is that one I mentioned, Mythos, Mythical Operating System. That's due this year. The next one is a little bit more, while this one's pretty dense and pretty mind-boggling, the other one's a little bit more lighthearted and fun. It's about Texas encounters of the strange and odd, basically, what we've been talking about with strange things here in Texas, from the creatures to the UFOs and all of that. So that one's a bit more fun. I'm supposed to have that one out by next year sometime.
Awesome.
Other than that, Mythos, as far as I know, is supposed to be kind of a standalone deal. I don't volumes. I'm trying to get all of it into one sort of publication, but might be something else. I don't know. But other than that, and the Texas book with fun encounters and strange things, there are just a few look at, like the Decalogue Stone one, just something real brief, not a huge tome, I'm sure someone out there should probably write that, but I don't think it's going to be me.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those things that I was there and, here's a little like that from some of the places I've been. Other than that, I need to finish up my videos. So, the Vortex on YouTube, can be a place. And I always share articles. I always find great things online that I like to share on the Facebook page that I don't personally write, but I think it's deserves enough recognition to show that there's so many amazing things out there being discovered every day. And that's, I think, a good part of how we learn and grow.
Daniel, it's funny because a lot of people say that about the Dudes and Beer Group, and it literally took years for the Dudes and Beer Group to organically grow to the point of other people sharing articles, to the point of people having open, unfettered conversation about things. And it's great. It's fantastic to see that our audience does take that time, that they do go through, that they do whenever they see things like, oh my God, did you see this? Like knowledge drop, boom. They hit it now, and it's great. So for me to be able to be sharing stuff from your sites and what you're following, and be sharing your group to our group, man, that's what it's all about, is really getting that word out about each other, about the cause, and just all trying to investigate with each other, and trying to bounce experiences off each other.
That's just it. And, you know, I don't claim to, at least as far as this new project, the one I mentioned, the book I'm writing, Mythos, I don't know that I'm like presenting these things organically as my own invention of them per se, rather than just saying, look, you know, there's so much out there and so many specialists in these areas. I realize that not one particular person, it seems, has been able to cover everything, although there are some great people out there who do a tremendous amount of work. I'm very honored, you know, to have met many of them, but I think that those are my influences. And of course, Jacques Vallée is someone who I think I really look up to, and the work that he did in the field of ufology that took it outside of ufology. It connected consciousness, it connected the paranormal, and it connected things that otherwise the nuts and bolts side doesn't really consider. And I think that just someone like that, and then others who are very much a part of my interest, I think helped to show that there, you know. And of course, I didn't mention this. I met, I had the honor to meet Michio Kaku a few years ago.
Nice.
He's very much a nuts and bolts science guy, but he's open to the quantum realities, and he's now open up to the ET hypothesis, and he talks about the Kardashev scale. And I draw from all of these. I try to be a sponge and to absorb all of the interesting things I can, not to say that I'm going to eventually agree with this or agree with that or this or that. I think where the source of the information derives, the integrity of the information, the interest of the information, and how relevant it can be in helping to develop our society further. And so what I've done in Mythos is just to compile these otherwise individual and maybe even sometimes non-related categories of disciplines, and then bring them into the mix with these unexplained mysteries, where they fit, maybe where they lie, maybe pose questions and posit inquiry into, maybe we can figure this out by asking different questions. Maybe we're not asking the right questions, and maybe someone out there who has the know-how and the resources will do it.
Yeah, exactly. And I, you know, with that in mind, like, please, everybody, make sure to stop on by. Check out the Vortex on Facebook. Check out the Vortex on YouTube. Tell them where they can go to find everything, Daniel.
Well, right now I'm in the process of kind of reconstructing my main site, and that's the vortex.online. But I think the best place right now, just the most accessible and convenient for people, is the Facebook page. If you need to type it in, it's just facebook.com/thevortexofficial. And then the YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/thevortex1, like the number one. And those have all the videos I've uploaded. Tons more on the way. Facebook page is full of fun articles, interesting news reports, and just stuff from all over. I try to post pretty credible, reliable news sources. Nothing really from just secondary or tertiary sites that I think, you know. And sometimes maybe I do. It just depends on what it is. I really try to adhere to the standards of journalism that we can count on. So
that's right.
That's where I am. You can also follow me. I've got my own personal Facebook page. I share a lot of different things. Sometimes stuff I'm more interested in outside of like the scope of the Vortex, because you and I we're more musically inclined. We like to we're into culture, pop culture stuff. So check it out. You know, if you have any questions, feel free to contact me. Send me a message on there. Let me know what you think about any of the videos for anyone who's checking this out, and I'd be glad to connect. I'm very accessible, and
absolutely.
I like to others. So, Chris, I really be on the show with you. I look forward to all the great response and just all the good things that come from our collaboration. And I'm glad to be here with you guys.
Absolutely. Please do hold the line one moment while we close things out. Daniel, thank you so much for taking the time to come on tonight. To share these concepts, share these ideas, share your passion about them with our audience, and expose them to them as well as expose them to the Vortex. Once again, hold the line while you're online, checking out the Vortex on YouTube, on Facebook, on thevortex.online. You can find everything in tonight's post on dudesandbeer.com. You can also find the documents that we talked about in the Knowledge Vault. I have saved the ones that we spoke about this evening, so they will be going up as well. Make sure to stop on by our parent network, HG Universal Network, as well as Podcast Cadet. Don't forget to use that code DUDES20, everybody, while you're on there doing that. Thank you all so much. This is episode 277. It does not seem like we've got literally 3-4 days worth of material out there. It's insane. More than that, actually, now that I start doing them. Anyway, coming up on 300 soon, so stay tuned, everyone. Until next time, if you can't be good,
thanks,
be good at
listening
it.
To this episode
Bye-bye.
Of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.